STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, my dear friends. The show is Stand to Reason, and I am the show's host, and yours truly, Greg Kokel here. Glad to be with you today. And I'm looking forward to our conversations, our interactions on the phone, and reflections I have on a number of things, including some cast-off reflections about Easter weekend and some passages that I read related to Easter, and I'll be getting to that as we move on in the show. But here, kicking off the show, I've got Alan Schliemann in the studio with me. Hi, Al.
Hey, Greg.
We have our staff meeting today, and so a lot of times we knock things around at the staff meeting that we realize would be good to knock around a little bit on the air for your benefit. Alan, of course, one of our premier speakers at Stand to Reason, and specializing in all of the controversial areas like Islam and homosexuality and same-sex marriage, evolution, abortion, those kinds of things. And he covers all the ground that the rest of us cover in a general way, but also he's our expert in these areas. So we often go to him sometimes for help. And not only do we go to him for help and counsel, but more and more other churches are doing so. And in fact, Alan, you told a story here today that I think it'd be good to pass on to the listeners that have to do with a community church, a local church. I mean, it's just I don't mean a church local to us. I mean a church, just like the ones you go to, listeners, that is grappling now with a peculiar circumstance that has come up in light of the broadly popular acceptance of homosexuality, same-sex marriage, gender confusion, cross-dressing, you know, all of those kinds of things are now things that the church has to grapple with. And sometimes it's not easy for us all as Christians to know how to deal with these things. And you have some great guidelines in your own book on with regards to homosexuality, on the Ambassador's Guide to
Understanding.
There it is. Thanks. I was searching for that word. Understanding homosexuality, that there's a truth in compassion. Balance. There are components of both that have, give us the greatest opportunity to be both faithful and have an impact in the person's life. That's on a one-on-one basis, on an individual basis. But when one is dealing with these things in the community, in the church proper, well, then it gets a little dicier, it seems to me, Al, because now you've got obligations that are part of the nature of being belonging to the Christian community, and you also have the church leadership that has to make decisions that reflect their faithfulness to Christ on these things. And so this is why I'm not surprised you're getting more calls, because there's so many things that you've really thought through carefully. But there's one that you encountered recently, and this was a new one for me. But it's the kind of thing that I know is are going to be coming up with churches around the country, and we need to know how to navigate this. So why don't you tell us about the phone call you received and the particular circumstances that this church was facing, and then the challenge and your counsel regarding this particular challenge.
Yeah, the call was from a church, a conservative Bible-based church that is probably the best way I describe it. And they were asking for advice as to how to proceed with regarding this particular situation. And here's kind of how the situation was described to me. Mm-hmm. There is a couple who's attending the church, a man and a woman. They're married, have kids, just like any other couple that you might see in a church. But recently—
the members in good standing kind of thing, as
right.
far as you—
yeah. Okay. That's right, as far as I know, yeah. But recently, the man, the husband in the relationship, has felt like they were actually a woman. And so they decided to change over and become a woman. So they became transgender.
He did.
Yeah, he did, the
yes.
husband. So So at this point, the husband and wife continued to maintain their marriage relationship.
Okay, just for clarification then, this is not a person who is struggling with same-sex attraction. This is a person that's simply maybe not anymore struggling with a gender confusion and decided to adopt outwardly the gender identity that he was experiencing inwardly.
That's correct.
So this is just simply a matter of living as a woman, even though he's married to a woman who he has regular, ordinary, healthy conjugal relationships with.
That's right. Yeah. To the best of my understanding, that's exactly what we are being presented with.
That's why it's such a, in my mind, a unique circumstance, because it focuses entirely on the gender confusion issue as it touches the church community and not any other behaviors that might be complicating same-sex attraction, the desire to get into those homosexual unions or maybe even living these things out, not being able to fulfill conjugal obligations to his wife. None of that's on the table here. It is just simply a matter of gender confusion.
That's right. That's right. So what added additional complexity to this is that this person then decided to attend a women's Bible study at this church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, initially, there was no problem with that. People didn't necessarily notice that this was actually a man who was presenting themselves as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually some people found out and were, you know, raised some concerns and questions about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the leadership of the church decided that they need to think carefully about what they should do at this point. Should they allow this person to continue to attend a women's Bible study?
What was the, in your mind, what was the conflict that they were facing as leadership?
Well, I think they were, I think some of the women in the Bible study had expressed concern that they felt like, well, wait a minute, this is a women's Bible study. Why do we have a man in here? I mean, granted, the man is expressing himself as a transgender person, but nevertheless, they knew full well he still is a man. He still has his man parts and all that comes with being a
he's
man.
He's male.
He is a male, yeah. But he's adopted a female name and has taken on a female identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're troubled by this because they, as any Christian, you know, even if you're not necessarily a theologian, knows there's probably something amiss about what's going on here that doesn't fit with normal everyday church life, you know. And they felt uncomfortable by this. You know, why are we talking to this person as if they're a female when in actuality they're a male?
So the theological, I mean, part of the concern too and the part of the leadership of the church is to be theologically sound and not just for the sake of theology but for the sake of fidelity.
Yeah.
You know, part of the conflict, how do I deal with this before Christ? What's the right action to take before Christ? Now, it seems to me if the problem, that maybe this is between the rock and the hard place situation that they're in, is if they do the theologically sound thing, well, then this possibly appears insensitive to the individual who has adopted his internal gender identity as his external gender identity, too, so to speak.
That's right. Yeah. And they're acknowledging, look, this person seems to display a genuine interest in spiritual things, is interested in attending a Bible study and learning about the Bible and following God. So there is a sense in which they feel like, oh, man, you know, we don't want to push this person away because they are a seeker and perhaps even identifying as a Christian. So
Perhaps even being a Christian, would you say?
Yeah. I don't know if... I'm trying to remember from the conversation whether I know that was the facts. But it seems like for all intents and purposes, they're presenting themselves as a Christian.
Yeah, and do you think it could be the case, somebody in the circumstance that's being described here with gender confusion, even though they want to live according to their internal gender identity, which is different than their body, they still could be a Christian?
Yeah, of course.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, so after the conversation, I literally said to the person, I said, you know what? Can I just get a day to think about this? I had some initial thoughts about what I wanted to say, but I wanted to be careful.
Right.
And again, this is new not just to the church. It's new to me. It's new to a lot of people. We're experiencing these kinds of situations. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to make sure that I was thinking carefully and correctly about this. So yeah, I wanted a day to reflect on it.
Yeah, and you need to balance things like the theological issues and then the sensitivity issues. And what about that person's spiritual life? And if you say no to them, then will that person go somewhere else where they're not going to get the rich spiritual input that they might at that church and go to a gay-friendly church that is going to be compromised in other ways? So there's a lot of things on the table here that you have to juggle.
Right, right. So after the day, I called them back. The person had contacted me and basically shared what I thought would be kind of a wise way to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him this. I said, look, if it was me, I would try to tell this person, the person who's presented themselves as transgender, I'd say, look, we love you. We're excited that you've come to our church. We want you to be a part of our fellowship and attending our sermons and learning from what is being presented here at the church. But I just want you to realize that what I'm about to say may make you doubt our sincerity about that.
Right.
Because sometimes the truth comes is difficult to hear.
Right.
And I said, as a church body, as a church family, we don't have the freedom to do just whatever we want.
Mm-hmm.
We're obligated to affirm what God affirms and to reject what God rejects. And so in this sense, we can look at Scripture and see what it says about matters relating to this. Obviously, you know, transgenderism isn't something that's dealt with specifically mm-hmm. in the Bible. But I said, look, it's pretty clear that God has created man and woman in a the way they are in order to engage in heterosexual conjugal acts, right? Mm-hmm. We are designed to function heterosexually, male and female.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, two became one, be fruitful and multiply. You know, it's that all goes together.
That's right, that's right. So in order for a man and a woman to come together in a one flesh union, each of those two people, the man and the woman, has to adopt a gender identity that is consistent with their biological sex.
Mm-hmm.
So a person born biologically male needs to adopt a male gender identity, and conversely, or as well, with a female, they have to adopt a female gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
And without that happening, you can't achieve the one flesh union that's described in Genesis and, of course, mm-hmm. elsewhere in Scripture. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, this is the clear expressed intent of God on the matters of gender identity and of sexuality. Therefore, the church doesn't have the freedom to simply affirm something other than that.
Right.
And so therefore, they can't allow this person to continue to attend a women's Bible study, mm-hmm. presenting themselves as a female when in actuality they're a male.
Right.
Because then they're affirming this thing, which clearly is contradictory to what Scripture teaches.
Right. In his case, though, he is able to fulfill his conjugal responsibilities even with his gender confusion, but your point is that what Scripture identifies is what God's purpose and ideal happens to be.
That's right.
And so for them to kind of side with this Christian man, we'll just give him the benefit of the doubt, because I agree with you. I think it's possible to be confused about all kinds of things,
sure,
and still know the Lord. But if they were to side with him, then they would be saying that something that is inconsistent with God's plan and purpose, known by both special and general revelation — you don't need a Bible to figure this one out —
right,
they would be actually affirming against God. They'd be siding with him against God on this issue.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's why I think it's a significant issue, and that's why I encourage them to say, look, let's try to do this in the most loving possible way.
Right, right.
Now, I also added an additional kind of component to my advice to them, and that was this. Although they might formulate a theological answer and a response before they went ahead to present this mm-hmm. to the person, my advice was to have them actually consult an attorney. And it doesn't necessarily mean to, you know, go deep into some kind of, spending thousands of dollars in investigating this kind of thing. But
still, this is a hard reality of the nature of the circumstances nowadays.
Right.
People are litigious about this.
That's right. That's right. So to consult an attorney and get their feedback so that as they present their views, their concerns, their decision on this matter, that they would have an attorney to be able to help put it in a way that can protect them in most cases. Obviously, you can't be protected entirely from lawsuits or, you know, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. But at least do whatever they can to avoid any kind of unnecessary, obvious mistakes in the way they present their concerns
really good.
To this person.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not assuming that the person is like a plant, that they are intending to try to provoke the church to.
Though that does happen.
Although it does happen. But, you know, I don't want to assume that that's the case. But even if it's not the case, I think that every church needs to start taking some steps with regarding this matter, because it's going to become more common where people, churches, are presented with people who either express themselves as transgender or same-sex couples, and they're going to be wanting to come to church, and they're going to be having to wrestle with these mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. In fact, the very next day after I had this conversation, I had another call from another church asking me to help them to draft a position paper on the question of homosexuality and how this church is now going to take a stand on the issue of same-sex marriage and homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And I told them the same kind of thing. I said, not only do you need to draft this paper and think through this with your leadership, but you need to get some kind of legal counsel to help you think through some of the possible situations in which – you know, something might happen where somebody
might be vulnerable to.
That's right.
I know the ADF, the Alliance for Defense of
Alliance Defending Freedom.
Defending Freedom. Yeah, they changed their name, but they kept the acronym. The ADF has done some work on this, and I've been directed to their website. I talked about it in the past year. I just don't know exactly where that spot is. But what they do is they have some boilerplate documents that can be downloaded and be used as and the board for local churches can sign off on it and duly pass it. It's in the minutes and everything. So it provides the kind of legal defense, if you will, or the legal foundation for being able to make these kinds of decisions with and avoid a lawsuit at the same time. Now, like you said, Al, there's no way to guarantee that one won't get sued, but there are smart ways to do this, and then there are some ways that are not so smart, even though they're principled. And so we have to be shrewd in the way we go about this. I think that's mm-hmm. a really good bit of advice there, and that's true for every church. If each church does not have these things in play, sooner or later somebody's going to ask to have a same-sex wedding at the church, and maybe even ask the local pastor to officiate. Then what? Well, if you don't have your ducks in a row here, you can make yourself very vulnerable. So I recommend going to the ADF website and poking around there. Maybe Amy Hall, who's listening to the show and weighs in with some of the details. Do you have it too, Melinda? Melinda, she's running the Twitter feed right now. In both of those cases, you'll be able to find the links that are necessary to go there. Let me tell you something else that bothered me about this this whole circumstance is the frame of mind of the man. Okay. Again, conceding for the sake of discussion here that he loves the Lord, he's a Christian, he's regenerate and all that, and people who are regenerate can have a whole host of problems. Mm-hmm. I know you kind of personally, Alan, I know you're an absolute basket case. So, and you know me well enough to say the same thing about me. So we're not looking for any kind of perfectionism here. Yet at the same time, one would like to think that a regenerate person who understands the lay of the theological land, faced with the internal struggle they're faced with, would be at least willing to acknowledge that this is not the way God intended it. Mm-hmm. And even if it may be that they're giving into these impulses, like we all give into wrong things at different times, they wouldn't make a demand on the church to go along with them. And I know a little bit about the circumstance that you talked about, that when there was pushback given by the church at some level, the individual got offended. And, you know, I wondered, why wasn't there a kind of a fair-minded sensitivity to the difficult situation that he was putting the church in? But instead, it seemed like he was adopting a completely worldly approach to this. This is the way I feel, and if you don't support the way I feel, I'm offended. Mm-hmm. I'm offended. That was discouraging to hear that.
Yeah, you would think that they'd have some understanding of like, look, this is obviously a conservative church. They probably don't have regular people who are transgender and homosexual attending them. I mean, it's possible they do, but chances are this isn't an out and open kind of thing where lots of people are there like this. They should understand it. Oh, yeah, they're probably going to have questions, and they may not even act consistently the first time. I mean, maybe they'll make a few mistakes along the way of processing this new situation. So you would think there would be some sort of grace given to the church on this matter. And perhaps there will be in the future. I don't know.
But. Yeah. Well, we'll see. Well, we hope that your counsel, in their case, now offered on the air, will be a guideline to others. And I cannot emphasize for churches the importance. I can't overemphasize. I couldn't emphasize too much is my point for churches to be faithful to Christ on these issues. It doesn't mean they can't be sensitive. They can't be loving. But they can't take their cues from the world here. I think it's a different thing when we're dealing with individuals. There's a different latitude I think we have, and this is something that you teach in your Ambassador's Guide to Understanding Homosexuality. But when it comes to the leadership of the church, you know, I think of Paul's exhortation to Timothy there in 2 Timothy 4, you know, preach the word. Reprove, rebuke, and exhort with great patience in your teaching, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate to themselves teachers according to their own desires. And this is such a problem nowadays. I think churches have to be extra vigorous to be faithful to the truth that has been delivered to them, entrusted to them indeed. Just before we go, on a lighter note, but still serious, weighty. Yeah. Tell us about your the story related to your Ambassador's Guide to Islam, which is very popular and has been selling like hotcakes because it's such a good treatment of the issue, and it gives great strategies on how to engage Muslims in a gracious but powerful and effective way. I categorize what Alan's about to share with you in the tell me there's no God heading, you know. So tell us about what you just learned about your workbook, your Ambassador's Guide.
Yeah, so there's a man, a Christian man, who lives in a community where there is a mosque nearby his home. And so apparently the mosque was offering an open house, where so they're inviting people in the community to come and check out the mosque and learn something about Islam, to sort of demystify Islam and Muslims to the community that probably doesn't know much about it. You know, all they probably know are stereotypes. So this Christian man thinks, okay, yeah, I'm going to go check it out. I'm going to go to this mosque and see what they have to say. I think he attended some classes or saw a lecture or something like that where they kind of gave an overview of Islam. And as he was leaving, they had a book table in which they were offering some free books they were passing out to people who were attending the mosque and the little open house at the mosque. And it turned out that one of the books was the Quran, which, of course, you'd expect. This is what Muslims believe to be the literal words of Allah. But in addition to the Quran, they were also passing out my book, The Ambassador's Guide to The Ambassador's Guide to Islam. And this guy took both of these books, the Quran and my book on Islam, assuming that since this mosque and Muslims are passing them out, they're pro-Islamic.
With the title, The Ambassador's Guide to Islam, it never occurred to me that one might take it that way, but clearly those at the mosque did take it that way, and they purchased a bunch of these at their own cost and are handing them out for free to people who come into the mosque. All right.
Yeah, the guy said there's a stack of my book there that they're passing out along with the Quran. So he goes home and he starts to read my book. He may have read the Quran too, I'm not sure, but he read my book and he was puzzled by it once he finished it, because of course my book doesn't advance a case for Islam. It advances a case from the Christian worldview on how to engage Muslims with the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And of course responds to a number of other challenges that Muslims raise. So he thinks to himself, this is the worst defense for Islam I've ever heard, you know? And so he reads it again, thinking maybe he missed something. How come this book is advancing really a case against Islam when it was provided by a mosque? So he eventually thinks, all right, this is bizarre. I'm going to call and try to speak to the author of this book. And now, of course, you flip over the book. You see on there a picture of me and a little bio of me. But then it also has Stand to Reason's address and our phone number. So he calls up our calls up our office, and one of our staff answers the phone, and he says, "Yeah, I was, you know, reading this book on Islam that teaches me about, you know, about Islam, and I wanted to see if I could talk to the author, who's supposed to be a Muslim here, and be able to explain to me why this book says the things that he says." Mm-hmm. And she, of course, said, "Well, actually, who are you talking about? What Muslim is that works here?
What Muslim yeah. works for standard reason?"
She said, "Alan Schliemann, you know, the author of the book." And she's like, "No, he's not a Muslim. He's a Christian, you know." And he's like, "Oh, okay." And so eventually that kind of finally clicked and made sense to him that, yeah. or I don't think it made sense, but he now understood his confusion.
Yeah.
And really, this book does not advance a case for Islam, but rather a case
right.
against
well,
it.
Well, if you, it's like one of those things where you got something in your mind that's different from reality, and it causes your mind to begin to torque reality a little bit because you're convinced of this. It's like if you, I don't know if you've ever had like an ice cube in something hot or whatever, and you don't expect it there, and it hits your tongue, and you yeah. feel it feels like it's hot,
yeah.
like you're going to burn your tongue on the ice cube because it's such a dramatic. But the same thing here, he's got it in his mind, this is pro-Islam, and he's trying to read this in terms of pro-Islam, and it just isn't fitting. He hadn't realized this is really written by a Christian. But what the tell me there's no God kind of aspect to this is, here is a Muslim mosque who saw, however they found out about the ambassador's guide to Islam, I don't know, but it's clear that they did not read this. They took it simply to be an advocacy for their view, written by Alan Schliemann, whoever he was, stand to reason. Well, they're in favor of reason, and here's this Alan who's a resident expert on Islam, devoted much of his life to addressing questions of Islam, son of Iraqi immigrants and well-schooled in Islam. There you go. Okay, that's what they read in your bio.
Right.
And so they
unwittingly. And the cover, too.
And the cover, yeah, of course. There's the star and the crescent. And there they are unwittingly selling a book, giving a book away, our book away, along with the Quran. That's just great. Yeah, like, tell me there's no God and tell me God does not have a sense of humor. Anyway, that's great. That's good news. Great story, Al. Thanks yeah. for your counsel here.
Yeah, sure. No problem.
We really appreciate
thanks.
It. All right. Let's take a break. We're a little over time on this, and I got a lot of callers I'll get to when I return on Stand to Reason.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles, follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
All right, friends, back with you here, Stand to Reason. And incidentally, I'm leaving tomorrow morning for Pensacola, Florida, and I'm actually spending 4 days there doing a number of things, including a Biola conference Friday night and Saturday with Craig Hazen and Clay Jones and Jay Warner Wallace. I mean, that's going to be a high-intensity event. So if you are in the area, you can check out our website and maybe attend that event. On the 16th, I'll be in Hanford, California. I think I'm doing a Crisis Pregnancy Center fundraiser. That's midweek. On the 18th and 19th, St. Charles, Illinois, big church out there, and I'll be talking about the problem of evil in a series where they're answering challenges to Christianity, where I think the problem of evil is one of the greatest arguments or elements in favor of Christianity. There's a couple of ways I developed that. That's in the western suburbs of Chicago. And then I'll be in Barrie, Ontario, Canada on the 24th and 25th. I think I'm just flying into Toronto. So that's the Toronto, Greater Toronto. No, I'm not. Is that I'm driving from Toronto somewhere else? Yes? A pilot's picking me up. All right. Hour and a half flight? No, drive. Okay, so people in Toronto could drive to Barrie, Ontario. I'm not going. That would be B-A-R-R-I-E. Anyway, I hope to see some of you at some of those events in the next few weeks. I'm sure I will. Let's go to our first caller from Palm Beach, Florida, Tom. Tom, were you at that event that I spoke at Palm Beach a few months back? Maybe it was the fall, now I think about it.
No, I'm actually in Seagrove, Florida.
Oh, okay.
Seagrove Beach.
Oh, okay. All right. That's not near Palm Beach?
No. In fact, I'm 75 miles from where you're going to be in a couple of days.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, well, that's the other end of the state. And Florida's a long
Panhandle.
State, so that's like about 15-hour drive.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Well, Tom, glad to have you on board.
Yeah, in fact, I'll be seeing you in a couple of days.
Okay, great. Well, be sure to say hi.
Yeah. One thing before we start, I want to thank your wife and your two daughters.
Huh.
Because the reason for it is because they actually share you with the public when you go out and speak to everybody and teach us and inform us about these things.
You know,
and so they actually give up a part of their relationship with you to share you with us. And
well,
I really get it.
That is true, and it is very sweet of you to say that. I have to tell you, and this surprises me a little bit, and it touches me, that it is not infrequent that people say that to me. Generally, it's a woman that says, you know, please tell your wife and your, especially your wife, sometimes your children, thank you for sharing us, you know. But I am so touched that you're sensitive to that. And yes, it is a sacrifice for them. I'm leaving tomorrow morning. I'm going to be gone until Sunday. Make it Saturday night. Then I have Sunday with them. Then on Monday, I have videotaping. Then on Tuesday, I have today, you know, staff meeting radio show. It's a 13-hour day for me. And then Wednesday, I think I go somewhere else, you know. So this month is particularly dense. This isn't the way it is every single week, but I had January and February pretty much all here in Southern California. My events were here. But yes, it is does take a toll on them, and I try to be mindful of that. But I will pass your comments on to my wife and girls, and my wife always appreciates that.
But also, I'm glad that you have a strike of balance, like you take vacations with them and spend time, you know, with them and stuff, so it's important.
Yeah,
that,
I do. I'm gone like 7 to 11 days a month, so that's not too bad, but it's enough to be a sacrifice. And then it comes in, you know, I'll have a couple months where I'm really got a lot of density, and then it'll slow down for a couple months, you know. So anyway, thank you so kindly for that. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. But the reason I'm calling is because back in, I think it was like September, October, you had a young college woman call about forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember all the details and stuff, but, you know, you said about the importance of, you know, forgiveness and everything. But also, you did mention, I remember, just mentioned it, that the part I want to emphasize more is when you forgive somebody, that does not release the person that you're forgiving of the consequences of what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
Because lots of times I think people are afraid to forgive because they think in their minds that if you forgive somebody, then that lets them off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no way true.
Well,
pay for the consequences for whatever they did.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking I'd want to qualify that, but in general, I agree with you. When we're training our daughters and they do something wrong, there's a time for confession and forgiveness, okay? But that doesn't mean that the discipline that is appropriate for the behavior is somehow evaded, because the discipline has a different role. Yes, we want to restore and repair the relationship, and so it's important for them to say they're sorry and to ask for forgiveness. And in our case, when children ask for forgiveness, we forgive them, and once that issue is resolved, then it's over with. Then we don't revisit that, we don't remind them, we don't put it over their head. It's forgotten in that
way. Right.
However, that does not mean there isn't a discipline that accompanies it. So that's what I mean when the whole circumstance is resolved. If there's significant wrongdoing, then there may be discipline that's associated with it, even though there is forgiveness. And I'm thinking of David here and Nathan and Bathsheba, the whole thing, Nathan being the prophet, who nailed David. You know, and David was forgiven. In fact, for the last month or so, I've been reading Psalm 51, his prayer of confession, almost every day. And it's had a salutary effect on my own life. But though he's confessing and repenting, he did not avoid the consequences of his behavior, which were the division of his own house. And the conflict that dogged him for the rest of his life. Now, God forgave him, and this is where I want to qualify. When we ask for forgiveness from God, yes, he does forgive us for Christ's sake. But that doesn't mean that now we're off scot-free. It's just as if we never sinned. It doesn't work that way. And sometimes we can kind of slip by the natural consequences of our sin, but sometimes our house remains divided as a result of our sin. And God in his grace chooses not to repair that. It's a consequence of our behavior that we have to live with, even though in his courtroom we are forgiven and cleansed. So that's a really good point.
Yeah, but I just want to, and also, yeah, I just want to pray, especially if it's somebody else that offends you, I don't want somebody to think that if they forgive somebody, they're hesitant to forgive because they think that then the other person gets off scot-free.
Yeah. Well, sometimes, in a certain sense, what forgiveness involves is releasing somebody of a debt. So there is a sense in which that you are letting them off free of some aspect of the debt. It doesn't mean that they don't escape certain consequences of it, but you are letting them off free of certain aspects of the debt. And there are times, too. I'm thinking of Proverbs, I think, 19, and it's a call-out for my eldest daughter, because we've gone over this a bit, dealing with her younger sister. Call-out is when I say a part of the verse, and then she gives me the second part of the verse. And the verse says, a man's discretion makes him slow to anger, and it is his glory to overlook a transgression. Now, I know that because I've done the call-out with my daughter, and also I've drawn on it myself. There are times when I feel wronged by someone close to me, but instead of pressing the issue and defending myself, and, you know, sometimes the best thing to do is just let it slide. And it is actually a matter of character to be willing to let certain offenses slide. It is his glory to overlook a transgression. So, you know, what you do in a given circumstance, you know, sometimes that's a little bit more difficult. But I think your point is a sound one, Tom. All righty.
Okay. Well, thanks, Todd. I look forward to seeing you a couple of days.
I will see you in a couple of days. That's right. Thanks, Tom. Tom, not from Palm Beach, Florida, but from the Panhandle where I'll be starting tomorrow. Let's see. Let's go. We had a late break last time, so let's just grab this one here. Carrie, let me find your button here. Carrie from Maryland, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for picking my call.
Sure. You know what? I'm looking at this topic. I want to put you back on hold. And
okay.
The reason is because Brett Kunkel is going to come in here and be part of this conversation.
Okay.
And but we need to have a break before then. So we're going to take a quick break. Let's see. How do I put him on hold? Push the top button there. Okay. I'm going to put you on hold, and hopefully you'll still be here when we get back. Yes. And we'll take a quick break and then back with Carrie and Marilyn on Bake a Cake for Two. You'll hear what that's all about when we return on Stand to Reason.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to Timothy, his disciple, and encouraging Timothy to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure in 2 Timothy 1:14. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman who has the job of protecting those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that's been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. It reflects the heartbeat of Stand to Reason, too. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we're training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful resources to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's str.org.
Stand to Reason's new Quick Reference app is now available for free on Apple, Android, and Windows mobile devices. The STR Quick Reference app summarizes the information you need to know about tactics, abortion, and other relevant topics through text and video, equipping you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the most important issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Download the STR Quick Reference app today and be prepared to respond with knowledge, wisdom, and character everywhere you go.
Back at you here on Stand to Reason, Greg Kunkel and actually Brett Kunkel on board here, on his knees here in our studio. Didn't drag the... Hi, Brett.
Hey, Greg.
This is the... Come a little closer there. This is our, this is our tag team hour here. We have a caller in Carrie in Maryland who's got a question, I think, that we actually been batting around a little bit with emails on the staff, and you were principal in that. So, Carrie, welcome back, and tell us what's on your mind.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the ministry. And let me just get right to it. A Christian friend of mine read an article that had to do with baking a cake for gay couples.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the person is a non-Christian. And
by the way, this would be baking a cake for a same-sex wedding, not just for a gay couple. Is that correct?
Let me see. The article is not really discussing whether it's a wedding or not.
Okay.
Although I think that's where this person is going with
it. I think it's speaking to that issue because
exactly,
I know nobody. I know lots of Christians and lots of Christians who have
wouldn't
a very.
Be an issue.
It would not be an issue. It's hard for me to imagine anybody denying
right.
services to anybody simply because they're
right.
gay. I mean, everybody's a sinner, for goodness sake, you know?
Yeah,
so,
absolutely. And,
so it's not just baking a cake, but it has to do more directly
with
the same-sex unions that the baking is contributing to or for or regarding, right?
Exactly,
so, okay,
exactly.
Good.
In fact, the author of the article is stating that she's using scripture, and she's not a Christian, but she's using scripture to show that Jesus, if he was in the situation, would not only bake a cake, but go the extra mile.
Yeah, yeah.
In the statement in Matthew.
Yeah.
And
Sermon on the Mount,
Yeah. And her point is that she does get, later in the article, she does mention situations where the ACLU will go against a business because they force them to serve in a same-sex union, and would it be better for them to refuse or to be loving and go the extra mile.
Gosh, when I hear this stuff, my blood begins to boil. You know? My blood just begins to boil. And partly because, and this is something Brett will get to, partly because well-meaning Christians, and I do not consider her in this in this example, because you said she's not even Christian.
Right.
And so it troubles me when you have people like Brett and I and others like us who have spent our lifetime studying the life of Jesus of Nazareth and have this person come in and lecture us on what Jesus would do, you know, based on cherry picking a passage. So but you have a lot of Christians who are well-meaning and they still will be taken in by this kind of approach, not knowing how to respond. So
exactly, And this friend of mine, he's a pretty fairly strong Christian, and I was really surprised that he said that he agreed with what she was saying.
Oh, God help us.
And I'm in the process of writing him a reply, and I just want to run this by you, how I'm framing this argument.
Uh-huh.
But basically, I see the problem as a category error.
Mm-hmm.
There's what Jesus' statement has more to do with insult and not about conscience,
mm-hmm.
The violation of a conscience. And I think that throughout the article, she's using that, she's pressing that passage into service for different situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I don't think that applies.
Yeah, I don't know that it's actually a category error. Error is when you ask a question about something that does not properly apply. So if you ask, how much does the color blue weigh?
Okay.
Well, color doesn't have a weight. Or when? How did? Who made God would be a category error, because God by definition is non-created.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't make any sense to ask who created an uncreated being.
Okay.
But I think what you are pointing out, though, maybe a better way of characterizing it, is that she's misapplying a text in a way that Jesus did not intend.
Okay.
I actually think there is a informal fallacy, and I think there's a straw man problem here, but I'll explain that in a minute. We got Brett Kunkel on board, and do you mind if he weighs in a little bit, Kerry?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Go ahead, Brett.
Yeah, yeah, Kerry, I want to clarify here first. If we're talking about the same article, it's actually an article from a blog called 10,000 Places.
Yeah.
And the article is entitled Bake for Them Too, and it actually is written by a Christian woman.
Oh.
And so she's citing Matthew chapter 5, right?
Mm-hmm.
A Roman law stating that a man is required to drop what he's doing and carry a Roman soldier equipment for him up to a mile. Jesus' response is in Matthew 5:41, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And then what she says later on in the blog post, she says, if you believe, and it is about gay marriage, she says, if you believe gay marriage is immoral.
Her term, not Brett's, because if it were Brett's term, I'd correct him right now.
Right. In parentheses, then she says, I don't myself. So if you believe gay marriage is immoral, I don't myself.
Mm.
And a gay couple comes into your shop and asks you to bake a cake for their wedding, what should you do? And then later on, she says, yeah, here's the kicker. If someone forces you to bake a cake for a gay wedding, bake for them too, right? Kind of playing off of Jesus' words in Matthew 5:41. And so she's pressing this passage into service here. And I think, I think a great way to respond is just by asking a question. And as a staff were kind of knocking this around, some counterexamples were thrown out that I think could help expose what one of the key problems is. And I think it was Amy who said, so you could respond with a question. Here's the question. If a man forces you to steal another man's cloak, should you steal for him too?
Hmm.
Greg weighed in with, I think, kind of a more modern day example. If a man asks you to make one pornographic movie, should you make two? And then actually I was reading in the blog comments, most of the blog comments were very approving. They were from Christians who are approving on this. And she actually wrote a little follow-up piece, said that she usually gets 100 readers per post. And this one has 300,000 readers on this post.
Oh, my
gosh. It's gone viral. And that's how I discovered it, because my mom – or not my mom, my wife – had seen a...
Is there a Freudian slip in there somewhere?
Let's not
she
go there.
She picks up your underwear and just like in socks, just like your mom did.
No detours here. So my wife pointed out a friend had linked to this, so I checked it out. But one of the commenters, I thought, asked a question, a great question. He said, okay, Jesus was a carpenter. If someone came into Jesus and said, carve me an idol, should Jesus carve too? Right.
Mm.
And so I think these are great questions to ask and then wait for the response. What's the response going to be? Well, I hope the response is going to be no.
Right.
Well, and if she says, well, no, you shouldn't do that. Well, why not? Well, because those things are immoral. Those things are wrong.
Yeah.
Aha. There's that. That's the key issue.
Bingo. Yeah.
Right.
Because, I'm glad you said that because in my response, I kind of asked those questions myself. I'm asking, is there a difference between a photographer being asked to take some shots of a man who claims to be gay versus a photographer being asked to take shots of a gay couple in a sexually suggestive manner?
Mm-hmm.
Or a difference between a baker baking a cake versus being required to join the celebration,
right.
Or being asked to harass people, or you know, is there a difference between being not to harass people with religious beliefs versus being allowed to pray in Jesus' name out of courtesy of folks who would object?
You know that what's so troubling. I already suggested this, but I'm just going to bring it up again. It's so troubling that Christians stumble here. And then the rest of the Christians weighing in. Now, she didn't even think same-sex marriages are immoral. Apparently, therefore, they're not inconsistent with God's plan. I mean, when you think of it, if God plans one thing and we do a different thing, then we are going against God's purposes. And if we're going against God's purposes, this is called rebelling against God at some level. And rebelling against God is called bad, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so she apparently does not think this is against God's purposes. But where in Scripture would she ever get the idea that this could not be against God's purposes? When Jesus himself said from the beginning, it has been one man, one woman joined together for life, and the two have become one flesh. You know, I mean, it's very straightforward there. But here's where I mentioned that I think this is a kind of informal fallacy called a straw man. A straw man is when you mischaracterize another person's view, and then you attack the mischaracterization.
Yeah.
This happens in the abortion issue, for example, when somebody says, listen, if you don't like abortion, well, don't have one. Don't participate in one. But that doesn't mean you got to stop other people from doing it. Well, notice how the pro-abortion person characterized the pro-lifer's point of view. You don't like abortion. Well, that's not our view when it comes to abortion. It isn't that we don't like it. We think it's wrong. If you don't like slavery, don't own a slave. We don't think it's not a matter of us not liking it. We think slavery is wrong. We think abortion is wrong. Okay, so now take that same line of thinking now and apply it here. What is the reason that photographers, bakers, etc., give for not participating in a same-sex union? What is the reason that they give?
Think it's wrong.
They think that if they think the union is against God's purposes, and in participating the way they participate, they are participating in something that is against God's purposes, and therefore they're culpable too.
Yeah.
So it has nothing to do with them disliking gays. It's irrelevant. But notice how this particular bake for them too does not take into consideration the real view of those who are objecting, and therefore it's guilty of a straw man. But look, at you erect a straw man of anybody's view, it's going to be very easy to knock it down, make it look ridiculous, and then get people who are simply untutored or not thinking very carefully to go along with you, which is exactly what she did.
Well, that's what really one of the things that really bothered me was that she's picking on baking a cake. And it seems to me that the reason she's bringing that up is because baking a cake seems so
benign.
Amoral,
Right.
Well, and that's where you can, I think, ask other questions, because she says in the blog post, Christians should be the first people baking cakes. And then she says, for everyone who asks us. And so here's a question. Well, then should we bake a wedding cake for a brother and sister who want to get married? Should we bake wedding cakes for a group marriage? Should we be forced to bake a cake for a white supremacist who wants to write racial slurs on a cake? Or how about the gay baker Should he be forced to write anti-gay messages on a cake for, you know, a church or something like that?
Yeah, there you go. Press their hot button there.
Yeah. And okay. So here's the key with the passage. You ask these questions to help help someone see that the example Jesus uses here of carrying a Roman soldier's equipment, that's amoral. That's not wrong
amoral,
in and of itself. But we're saying that, a same-sex marriage is immoral.
Mm-hmm. And if they say, look, taking pictures is amoral and baking a cake is amoral, my response is, you're right. It is amoral. Mm-hmm. The question isn't whether a cake should be baked or a picture should be taken, but rather a cake should be baked or a picture taken regarding this event. That's a whole different story. It's when you can connect an amoral thing with an immoral thing, then the first one arguably participates in the second.
Yeah.
And what if I just thought of another example, and this is actually a little bit more realistic in a certain sense. What if a non-Christian is marrying a Christian? Mm-hmm. Now, the scripture, this is clearly against scripture. Do not be unequally yoked with the non-believer. Right. Now, would a person be within their moral rights to say, I cannot participate in that, because I would be participating in something that was wrong?
Right.
I mentioned this last week. I'm a licensed pastor. I could marry. I did one wedding already, but probably the last one that I'll ever do, as it turns out. It's just not my thing. But if one of my requirements is that if a person who asked to be married, if they're both Christians or they're both non-Christians, well, then that's potentially possible. But if one is a Christian and one is a non-Christian, I would never even countenance participating in that, because then I would be joining together something that God says should not be joined together.
Yeah.
And wouldn't that be exactly the same circumstance?
I would
for
say
somebody
so.
Participating, at least arguably, and if arguably, then people should follow their conscience, and that's Paul's teaching.
Yeah.
Right? So there's nothing wrong with eating meat sacrificed to idols, but if you think it's wrong, well, then just follow your conscience. You know, your conscience may be misinformed at that point, but you should not injure your conscience even if it's misinformed. Why doesn't, what's her name here? I'm looking for a name. But bake for them too, 10,000 places gal. Why doesn't she read the Corinthians passage where Paul says, follow your conscience? This is cherry picking, you know.
Well, that's the other thing. I'm glad you brought that up about the Romans passage, because I was going to bring that up as well. Is that it seems more parallel to me, the conscience issue, like eating food sacrificed to idols.
Mm-hmm.
Different Christians have different sensibilities about that.
Yeah,
and we should
respect that.
Yeah, we should respect that.
Absolutely,
and that's a whole different issue than whether you're being insulted or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And the thing is, it's in that case, we know that eating meat sacrificed to idols is not wrong, because Paul says that. But in this case, arguably, at least theologically, that it's this whole idea of same-sex marriage is just flat out non-biblical and against God's purposes, and that puts it in an entirely different category than meat sacrificed to idols. Though that would be adequate, it seems to me. Anyway, Kerry, thank you for your thoughts, and Brett, thanks for your counsel.
Glad to join you.
That's it for this hour. More coming up as I reflect on Easter and some odd sideways kind of realizations I had as I looked at some of the passages related to the resurrection. That coming up here in hour number two on Stand to Reason. Welcome to the show, my friends. The show is Stand to Reason. And I am Greg Kokel, your host. Have been for a long time. Is this our 26th year? Is that right? I think so. Yes, 26th year in radio. 1990 to 2015. So that would be 25 years. But now we're into 2015, so that would be into our 26th year, right? Or is this our 27th year? I always get mixed up, you know, when you have that 0 year. That's a real year. So when you turn one, you're not beginning your first year. You just ended your first year. So if you start at 2014, that means you've finished your 14th year, and you're starting at 2015. You finished your 25th year from 1990. Okay, so this is our 26th year. I got it. I had to get my slide rule out for that. By the way, does anybody out there know what a slide rule is? Do you know what a slide rule is? See, Brooke, now she's what, early 20s? Would that be a fair way of putting? She's got a graduate degree. Oh, mid-20s. Okay, I don't want to give away your age, but she's my board op here. And no, she does not know what a slide rule is. Back before the age of computers and calculators, you had a device with a sliding thing on. You could do the most incredible calculations. You could find out how many molecules were in a liter of water using a slide rule if you knew Avogadro's number, which I can't remember anymore. And it doesn't matter because we don't use slide rules. But in any event, let's see. I said that I would offer you some reflections about my Easter weekend, and I have to start out by saying and this is kind of a qualifier. Maybe some of you will like this, maybe some of you won't. I don't know. But the qualifier is that I never really get spiritually turned on for spiritually significant holidays. It isn't like, here comes Christmas. Man, can you feel the vibe? Easter, whoa, I'm kind of getting elevated here a little bit. Good Friday, I'm down in the dumps in the steep meditation. And now it's Easter, yay, yay, yay. I mean, we do this at church, so there's nothing wrong with that. Hallelujah, he is risen, he's risen indeed. I think all that's good. Because what we have to do is we have to instruct ourselves about the significance of events that are genuinely significant, even though our emotions are not there at the time. And I have a suspicion that more people are like me in this regard than are willing to admit it out loud, because everybody else seems to be flying along in this emotional high during these times, hallelujah, when they aren't, so they just kind of go along and pretend and whatever. I'm not putting anybody down. I'm just saying this is human nature. And when it comes to spiritual realities, we are much less in touch with their significance than the reality deserves. Who understands? Even the one most emotionally elevated in reflection upon the cross, who gets that? I mean, I always have to confess to the Lord when I'm thinking about the cross that there is no way that I could ever understand the true, genuine, weighty significance of it. Now, we do exercises of reflection, and we have Lent, for example, or we have it for Easter. We have an Advent coming into Christmas. And those are to discipline our minds to think about things in a way that we wouldn't normally naturally feel like thinking about them. And I think that's a good thing. So we need to be instructing our emotions about what the way they should be responding, even if they're not. Because these events are truly worthy of a deeper emotional engagement than our fleshly selves, our fallen selves, ever give them. So I'm just being upfront here. I don't get that spiritually turned on about these spiritual holidays, but I do try to work at it. to reflect. So I got my Life of Christ in stereo, and I read, this is a combination of all the four Gospels in a very clever way. And I read the entire Passion account the other night to connect. And I reflected on passages like 1 Corinthians 15. My pastor actually taught it on Sunday, you know, the resurrection. And when I was reading, some things stood out for me. For example, as I read in Jesus' betrayal, remember when he was, and this is one that if you read Life of Christ in stereo, which is a particular version of a harmony of the Gospels, okay, and I think it was published in the 60s, Western Conservative Baptist Seminary Press, I think, put it together. The fellow who did that is no longer alive, but it's really great. And I had never read such a robust account of the betrayal of Jesus. And here all of the particular details are coming together. Because in one case, you have somebody draws a sword, Peter, whacks off the high priest's servant's ear. By the way, do you know his name? You know his name, right? Malchus. Why is that significant? Who would put the name of the high priest's servant into the account if he was making that up? Do you realize that the reason that the name is there is because there was a guy named Malchus who got his ear whacked? This is the kind of detail that you find in these accounts that don't make sense if they're just mythology, but make perfect sense if they're an account of what really took place. When Jesus is carrying his cross, right? So Simon the Cyrene, father of Rufus and Alexander, is pressed into service to carry the cross. Oh. Now, why do they have that in there? Father of Rufus and Alexander. I'll tell you why. First of all, this guy who carries the cross has a name, and they know the name, so they put it in the account. That's detail. And then he said, oh, by the way, he's the father of these other two guys, because probably the early Christian community knew them. They know Simon because my suspicion is he became a Christian. Yeah, Simon the Cyrene, you know, that guy who's the dad of Rufus and Alexander. I think I got the names right. Yeah, that guy. That's the guy who helped Jesus out. That's the same guy. Yeah, you know those guys. They're in your Bible study. It's his dad that carried the cross. Now, those are the kinds of things you might overlook, but they jumped out at me. I also noticed that there at the betrayal, Jesus said, don't fight against these people. Now, he gives a couple of reasons. One is there's who live by the sword, die by the sword. So there's a practical concern there. But he said there was a theological sense. Otherwise, how will the scriptures be fulfilled? Right? So Jesus, aware that he needs to be betrayed for all the plan to work out, is speaking to his disciples by saying not to interfere with the process. Now, why would he say that? Because by interfering, well, let me back up and put it this way. Even though God had a sovereign plan, there was still a role that the free will decisions of the disciples played in it. Judas, clearly, but also the disciples. That's why Jesus said, don't do that. You might mess things up. Now, how do you have this sovereign plan of God and the free will actions that might mess up God's sovereign plan? I'm not going there. But I know people have called me and said, hey, you know, what's the point of witnessing if God has already chosen? No, I think as a matter of scriptural verity, the truth of the text, God has chosen. I'm not going to argue that right now, but that's my conviction based on reading the text. But even so, even though God has ordained a certain plan, doesn't mean that human actions are irrelevant. That's why Jesus told the disciples, don't take the sword here and interfere, because the scriptures have to be fulfilled. So there is a very important role of human choices. Look at, you know, earlier on in Jesus' ministry, he is being opposed. They want to kill him. And so what does he do? He flees. He flees. He gets out of there. And he doesn't stay there and say, hey, I'm Superman because I'm not destined to die for 3.5 years and I'm going to be crucified so that you can drop all the stones on me you want and it's not going to hurt me. Go ahead, take a shot. And so there you have this interplay between individual responsible choices and God's sovereign plan, and there's no sense of conflict there. So if you ever wondered about if God has actually elected and chosen those who would be his, no one can come to me save the Father gives them to me, and all of those the Father gives me, I lose nothing but raise them up on the last day. That's pretty strong. That's in John 6, but even so, the role that we have in evangelism is significant in the process. There's still a part to play. God ordains the means as well as the ends. So that's something else that stood out as I was reading through the texts. I also noticed that there's a long time that passed. And actually, to be honest, my pastor pointed this out. So I got to give credit where credit's due, Pastor Doug. But I'd never thought of it before. There's a long time that passed between the resurrection and the ascension. Pentecost, 40 days, right? Or is that 40, Penta, or is that 50? 40. 50. 50 days. That's almost 2 months. Okay, 40 days to the ascension, and then there was another 10 days, Pentecost. Okay, thank you, enforcer. Appreciate that. She was the one who said, don't use numbers like when you talk to people because it makes you sound senile. So there she is to help me out. There was a long time between the resurrection and the ascension, 40 days, which, and this is something that this had not occurred to me. You know, one of the apparent explanation, one of the explanations for the experience of the appearance of Jesus to the disciples. Now, very few will deny that the disciples thought they experienced a risen Christ, okay, because they were willing to die for it. So they thought they had seen Christ. Now, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, well, then they didn't see Christ, but they thought they did. And therefore, they were willing to go to a martyr's death, but he didn't rise from the dead. And what they saw was just an hallucination. Well, you know what? You might get away with that with one appearance. Like one time, there's a flash in the pan, and one guy says, I thought I saw Jesus there. What? I saw something, too. Maybe it was. And so you kind of convince yourself. Of course, hallucinations are first-person private, like dreams. You don't have group dreams. Hey, man, honey, I just woke up, had a fabulous dream. Go to sleep with me right now. Let's hold hands, and we'll dream it together. There was a movie like that, wasn't there? A movie like that about a year or so ago when that people dreamed and they went back deep, deep into their dreams and they like almost never came back kind of thing because they were enjoying their dreams so much together. Well, that can't happen. That's science fiction. That's Hollywood, not reality. Hallucinations are in your head like a dream and you aren't going to have all the same hallucination at the same time. But one person might hallucinate and get the others to say, okay, yeah, I thought I saw a glimmer of light and maybe it was Jesus. Okay. But not time and time and time and time and time again. There he is. Touch my wounds. Look, I'm going to eat something. I'm not a vision. I'm not a spirit. Give me some fish. Wait, he had fish and a fig. Is that right? He ate some fish? No, this is when he was by the Sea of Galilee. He had some fish and some figs or something like that. Who eats fish and fig together? Was it fig? It was something like that. It was a fish and something else that doesn't go with fish. I'm just telling you. Sorry, I'm just saying. I'm not a fish eater anyway, but I certainly wouldn't eat fish with figs. What else do they have? Pomegranate? I don't know. But it just occurred to me that it was an odd combination. Maybe not for them. But they did eat together. He cooked for them. They saw him on the beach. At one time, there were, well, when Paul says that he appeared to more than 500, it's quite possible, and I got this suggestion from William Lane Craig, that the 500 were there on the ascension when he, that's when everybody all gathered together and he went up to heaven. The disciples were there and a lot of other people. So, and it does say in that passage, by the way, that some doubted. So why would an inventor of that whole thing throw in this, and some doubted? Because some did doubt, in fact, and it wasn't an invention. So that's another thing that just kind of stood out. It's one thing to have a flash-in-the-pan hallucination some night when you're really grieving and you've had a couple of too many of after-dinner drinks to soften the blow, the loss of someone close. It's another thing when it happens time and time and time and time again in multiple circumstances, and they're extended. Over 40 days. All right. Not a mirage. I don't think so. And then I noticed here, 1 Corinthians 15, of course, the great passage on the resurrection. For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received. Paul is saying to the Corinthians, I gave to you in the past. So this is something he already communicated to them. 1 Corinthians, what was that, mid-50s? Well, prior to that, he had already spoken to them about it. So that means this, what he's about to say, goes back further than that. And even when he told them about it, he said he had received it from others. So that pushes it back even further. Turns out what he's about to say is something that the Christians have been repeating for a long time, and Gary Habermas tracks it, along with other scholars, back to within a year or two of the event itself. In other words, this wasn't a myth that arose late, 100 years later. No, in fact, Romans, which is one of the, it's clearly Pauline epistle and written 20 years after the event, Paul says Jesus was declared with power to be the Son of God through the resurrection. That's the first couple of verses. Galatians, he wrote even before that, his first book. And there in the first chapter, he talks about the resurrection. So this idea of the resurrection was around for a long time. But Paul says, I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was raised on the third day, according to the Scriptures. By the way, notice he said, according to the Scriptures, twice. Why did he do that? Because he's saying this was prophesied. You know what he's doing? He is weaving into his discussion apologetics. Jesus died, and by the way, that was prophesied beforehand. The Messiah was going to die. Daniel 9, for example. And the Messiah will be cut off. All right? Oh, and he'd raise again. And that was also according to the Scriptures. Peter talks about that in Acts chapter 2. And so he's making an appeal here to scriptures that are fulfilled in this historical event. Which historical event? That they were witnesses to. Where does it say that? Next verse. And that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. And after that, he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. And then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, as it were, to one untimely born, he appeared to me also. Did you notice that how many times he used the phrase he appeared? And there are a couple of cases he was making reference to appearances, but he didn't use the word appeared, but he's got appeared in there. Let me see. And he appeared to see, appeared to, then he burned, appeared to Cephas, one, appeared to more than 500, two. He appeared to James, three, and he appeared to me, four. Why does he keep saying that word? Because it's important. He appeared. He appeared. And see, this is another thing that I didn't notice in the past, but going over it just this last weekend. And that's when I got my pencil out and I started circling these important things. Sometimes you see relationships, it's good just to circle them and see. He appeared, he appeared, he appeared, he appeared. You know what that reminds me of? Reminds me a little bit of 1 John, doesn't it? Remember that? What was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we beheld and our hands handled concerning the word of life, and the life was manifested. We have seen, we bear witness and proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father, which was manifested to us. What we have seen and heard, we proclaim to you also. Gee, all right, I get it, John. Over and over and over. Why do they keep doing that? Because this matters. We're not making this up, is what he's saying. We saw, we heard, our hands touched. What we see and we heard, we proclaim to you. Same thing in 1 Corinthians 15. So just some fun stuff that I stumbled across. Thinking, reflecting on Easter weekend while I'm reading the Word and also sitting in the Easter Sunday worship sermon. I was writing like crazy. I always take notes during the sermon, sometimes of the sermon, sometimes of things that I'm thinking about during the sermon. Sometimes the sermon stimulates these other thoughts, so there you go. All right, time to get to your calls. We'll do that after the break. I'm Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Okay, friends, your turn here on Stand to Reason. And let's go to Chula Vista, California. James, welcome to the show, James.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, glad to do so.
First, I'd like to thank you for your ministry. STR has made a big impact on my personal life and on my own ministry.
Oh, great. Glad to hear that, too.
Well, I'm calling regarding the religious freedom law in Indiana, and more broadly about Christian business owners being attacked over operating their business within the parameters of their conscience.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to offer a distinction between appropriate and inappropriate discrimination that our fellow ambassadors can use.
Mm-hmm.
And I offered this distinction on the blog section of our website and have gotten good feedback from it. So I'd like to run it by you and get your take on it.
Sure.
So step one involves taking the roof off the opposing view to show what reality looks like when a business owner can never discriminate.
Mm-hmm.
We do this by using clear case examples of appropriate discrimination. And you and Brett actually went over some of those examples, but
just
on a few.
Mm-hmm.
You know, such as a Jewish baker discriminating against making a cake with a swastika on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or how about when a Satan worshiper comes in a bakery and request a cake with an inscription that gives some praise to the devil.
Mm-hmm.
or, for example, a Satan worshiper that wants a Christian photographer to photograph their worship of Satan event.
Right, right.
Should the Christian photographer be forced to photograph that event?
Yeah, by the way, I like your illustrations because each of them have to do with the event proper and not with anything about the individual. That is, the service is not being denied the Satan worshiper because he's a Satan worshiper, but
right.
because of the kind of thing the Satan worshiper is asking the Christian baker, photographer, whatever, to produce. So
right.
I think it's a fair parallel here.
Right. And one of the last examples I like to give is with a homosexual business owner, because since homosexuals are the ones doing it, they're the ones being targeted.
Right.
They don't realize that. Actually, what we're fighting for is actually in defense of them if they're a business owner.
Yeah.
So for example, you know, should the homosexual T-shirt printer be forced to print shirts that are offensive to his beliefs?
Yeah.
You know, a shirt that would say something like, the Bible is clear, homosexuality is sin.
Uh-huh.
You know, that would insult his personal sacred belief
convictions.
That homosexuality.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There is a discontinuity in that illustration, though, because not that hurts our side, but that would hurt him because you can call it a sacred belief, but we're using the word sacred in a secular sense. It isn't as if his religion, his bona fide religion, weighs in favor of homosexuality or something like that. There's a distinction between having a personal belief about something and having a religious conviction about something. The religious conviction is what is protected by the First Amendment, not a mere belief. And that's
right.
why when it comes to our situation, we are talking about not just doing something that is inconsistent with our beliefs, but it's inconsistent with our religious convictions. And that is a different thing entirely. So
right.
You see the point.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that, but for whatever reason, the conversations, the way they go down now, is Christians are the one being demonized,
yes, right.
and religion itself is being demonized, and so it's kind of hard to even defend, even though it just seems blatantly obvious to us all that it's not only in the First Amendment, it's the first thing listed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm just trying to. Make the conversation easier.
Sure. Yeah, I think there's some that sound too, because I mean, I'm making a distinction that they may not be making. And if one wants to say, well, I shouldn't have to make a T-shirt that is anti-gay, how much more should a Christian's concern be respected? Because there is not only their belief, but it's also protected by a first freedom. I guess that's kind of the point. If we abandon, though, the first freedom element, that we have religious freedoms here, and then we've lost the ground of our complaint, or at least of our appeal regarding these things, you know. So anyway, just
sure.
a thought. But I'm following your strategic okay. approach. I'm following.
And so basically, the point of using these clear case examples is to get them to admit that there are cases where discrimination is actually appropriate.
Right. Very good.
And so the only question is, how can we distinguish between appropriate from inappropriate discrimination?
Mm-hmm.
And I've asked this to people, and they can't give an objective answer. It's always comes down to something subjective.
Mm-hmm.
So the second step is to provide them actually a framework that will allow us to objectively distinguish between appropriate and inappropriate discrimination,
mm-hmm.
and also protect the civil rights of customers while also protecting the freedom of conscience of business owners, and that's all business owners, not just religious ones.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the framework that I use is using the Declaration of Independence and the specific phrase, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that mm-hmm. all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator. And it's this phrase in the Declaration of Independence that's the basis of civil rights.
That's right.
That is, all men or people
right.
are created equal because we all bear the image of God, and it is this image that all humans share
mm-hmm.
that makes us all equal,
mm-hmm.
right?
Well, that's the way they were arguing, and I would argue, but people are hard-pressed to argue that way nowadays because they don't believe in God or they don't see any relationship between transcendent human rights and the God who ordains those rights in virtue of the way he's created human beings.
Right. Well, I guess if they challenged that, I would ask them, where do civil rights come from then? Mm-hmm. You know, where are they grounded? Mm-hmm. But anyway, if we do take it at its wording, it seems civil rights apply to personhood, mm-hmm. and therefore discrimination based on personhood of an individual via civil rights violation. So, example, a business owner saying, "Get out of my store! I don't serve you people, blacks, mm-hmm. homosexuals, etc." You know, that would be an example of a civil rights violation.
Right.
But what our civil rights do not imply is that all actions or causes are equal, mm-hmm. and that all actions or causes are endowed by their creator. So civil rights don't apply to actions or causes.
Or events.
Or events, right.
Yeah.
So if a discrimination is based on a service, ceremony, cause, a message, or action, or event, or ceremony, that violates the business owner's conscience, mm-hmm. then that's a legitimate discrimination because causes and actions are not civil rights. Mm-hmm. So an example would be a business owner saying, "I would love to sell you cupcakes and pastries for your birthday party, but I cannot create a cake or other products or services for your same-sex wedding ceremony."
Yeah.
That translates to, you know, "As my fellow man made in the image of God, I would love to serve you. However, I don't want to participate in desacralizing that which I consider sacred."
Yes, you know, yes. Yeah, well, that is a really good distinction. It's a really handy way of putting it. I appreciate that. Good for you.
Okay, well, thanks.
That also, I think what it does is, as you pointed out, it gives people a kind of a handy way of making these distinctions. But it also, it seems to me, would disqualify the kind of discrimination that people are pursuing against groups like the, well, I don't know, maybe I could ask you whether it would, groups like the Boy Scouts. Because
right.
there's all kinds of discrimination against the Boy Scouts. And I think it's so lopsided because all the Boy Scouts are saying is, given our Christian convictions, we don't want practicing homosexuals in our leadership, okay? Now, that at least arguably is defensible. It may be false, but it's not unusual, okay? It's not like this is a draconian action that is taken with absolutely no basis to it whatsoever, okay? I think a fair-minded person would say this is not draconian, and there, at least arguably, though I don't agree with it, at least arguably there's a moral basis for this decision. Now, you look at the kind of persecution or discrimination that has been put against the Boy Scouts, and the attempt has been to put them out of business.
Right.
For all the good the Boy Scouts have done in so many lives for so many years, simply because they don't want gays in their leadership, people are trying to entirely destroy the organization.
Right.
That's draconian.
Right. They haven't considered the idea that the discrimination is could be a safety issue. You know, the same reason you wouldn't allow male adults to lead a Girl Scout group, it's the same thing. We know that homosexual males are going to be attracted to these boys, and it's a safety issue.
Yeah, or at least potentially. At least potentially. A fair-minded person is going to say that. You're not going to have, a bunch of men hanging out with the Girl Scouts, you know, in a kind of a semi-intimate way for the reason that you've identified. It just doesn't make sense. Yet this is where, you know, people are losing their heads on this, and it's just the world gets upside down. James,
yeah,
go ahead.
One other thing, Greg, point I was going to make was that part of the reason that I wanted to focus on the discrimination thing in what I just outlined is it seems a lot of ambassadors and fellow brothers and sisters that are defending our position seem like they're focused on the just the facts, ma'am, approach to mm-hmm. responding. And so since we have this bulldozer just coming our way that are just steamrolling us with the accusations of discrimination, too many people are trying to just get away from that word, like it's too heavy to bear.
Yeah.
And I think we should just use that word.
I agree.
Okay, let's talk about it. You know?
I have always pled guilty to the charge of discrimination in this particular case, but with the qualification that not all discrimination is inappropriate.
Right.
To make appropriate discriminations is a sign of emotional and intellectual maturity, you know.
Right.
And so not just knee-jerk reactions, discriminating. You're black, you get in the back of the bus.
Right.
Discriminating for the wrong reasons, but making distinctions. Here is a ceremony that is inconsistent with my understanding of the biblical view of reality. So I have a religious concern about participating in any way. I ought to be allowed to be opted out. There are plenty of people that are going to bake this cake or take those pictures for these people. I don't know why I should be forced to when I have a religious concern. And
right.
I know some people will say, well, what about somebody who says, I got a religious thing against blacks, and so I'm not going to serve any blacks. My response is, okay, produce your religious argument. Produce it. What
right.
religious tradition says that except for Mormonism in the past with regards to the priesthood? You know, they had that, no blacks in the priesthood for a while. But really, what they don't now, but what religion, show me where in the Judeo-Christian or tradition or any tradition for that matter. Can one say, I can discriminate for religiously based reasons, and here's my source, chapter and verse, against people of a different skin color than me? Just because people make that claim doesn't mean it's a sound claim. In
right.
this particular case, we can back it up, can't we?
Yeah.
We can
absolutely.
Make the case scripturally. You can't do that with the race issue, not at all. Well, James, thanks for the call.
You're welcome. Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, got to run to break here, and then we'll be back with more on Stand to Reason.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
All righty now. Let's see. Just to let you know, I'm going to be speaking this weekend in Pensacola, Florida. And some of you listening to this, it will be too late, but I get on a plane tomorrow morning. Craig Hazen, J. Warner Wallace. We're all going to be doing an event together, actually multiple things here in the next couple days. I'll be in St. Charles, Illinois, the 18th and the 19th. That would be western suburb of Chicago. Hanford, Connecticut on the 16th. And the 24th and 25th, Ontario, Canada. Barrie, B-A-R-R-I-E. That would be north of Ontario, I think, or somewhere. North of Toronto is what I mean, but maybe not. Somewhere in that vicinity. Check it out on our website, and maybe you can participate. Let's talk to Frank in Pennsylvania. Hello, Frank. Welcome to Stand to Reason.
Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing
great
fine.
Show.
Thank you.
Love
Thanks.
Listening.
Thanks, Frank.
I have actually a two-part question on God's sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could give me your opinion of...
My 2 cents on your two-part question, okay.
Okay. The first one is, I work with a guy, we talk about God quite a bit, and we started talking about the Israelites being in bondage for 400 years,
mm-hmm.
and the question came up from my friend. He's like, well, maybe God has an overarching plan, which we obviously knew he did.
Mm-hmm.
If you read Genesis, it talks about the time of the Amorites not having been fulfilled yet.
Right. That was one detail, so, right.
Right, right. So our question, well, his response to me was, it's good for the people who happen to be at the end of the 400 years and are going out of bondage, you know, with the Israelites to get us free from the Egyptian bondage.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the people who were in the middle of the bondage?
It was a bummer for
God
them.
Was, yeah.
That was a total bummer for them, right?
Yeah. Well, what would you say to something like that? And can we? Is it reasonable to assume that that particular idea is the same today, where we may be praying for something like probably some of those Israelite slaves did, who were in only year 200 out of the 400 years
yeah.
of bondage? And maybe that's the same thing now, where you know God's overreaching scheme of plans,
right?
The end times and everything, that's going to take precedence over our personal, you know, prayers. And
yeah, well, you know. Well, I think in a general response, you are absolutely right. And to put it, to put a twist on an old phrase, it's not about God's plan for our lives. It's about our lives for God's plan. And we, to put it differently, we are expendable to God's purposes. Paul says in Philippians 2, I believe, if I am being poured out on the sacrifice and service of your faith, then I rejoice. Now, he's pretty noble. You know, when I'm poured out on somebody's service of somebody's faith, you know, poured out like a drink offering, and he was referring to dying there. I mean, I'm not exactly rejoicing, but I do understand that there are bigger issues at play here than just my puny desires and my puny hopes for my own puny life.
Right.
There are bigger designs, and my life is subject to God's purposes. I don't see the big picture. I see just my situation and what I want, and God sees the whole thing. So you mentioned here in that Genesis 15, there's a reference to the iniquity of the Amorites. He said, you will be sojourners for 400 years in a strange land because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. That is, that the Jews could not take over the land as an act of judgment on the people of of Canaan until they had filled up the fullness of their crime against God, and then God would bring judgment against them under Joshua and those that followed him. So it was an act of mercy, arguably, on the people of Canaan that God allowed them to continue on and give them more of a chance to change their ways, which they didn't. Okay. Now, this meant that the Jews had to suffer as a result. But God's, like I mentioned before, God's plans are the things that matter most. Yes, they were bummed out, I guess, because now there's, but that's not the only detail. And this is something a lot of people don't realize. You know that when the Jews were in the land, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, then the 12 sons or the 12 tribes or the 10 sons, whatever they were, there were 12 tribes, but Joseph had 2 sons. So what was going on there? Were these people all operating in terms of the divine program and their divine destiny? No, they were screwing up royal. Judah married a Canaanite. Other nonsense was going on. They sold their brother into slavery. I mean, all kinds of stuff was going on. And they're intermarrying there, and this all is having an impact on the stability, theological purity of this nation that is God intended to be the spokespersons to the rest of the world about his plan for rescue and redemption. This was God's plan. And through you, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. But these guys didn't get the picture. They're messing up royal. So what does God do? He takes advantage of their sin against Joseph, raises Joseph to the most powerful man in the kingdom, at the second most powerful man in the kingdom, and puts him in a position to rescue this fledgling nation of Israel, not only from their interbreeding and everything, but also from the famine that hit the land. They were starving. This then brings them under the protection of the Egyptian Empire and well-fed. And since the Egyptians were bigots, none of those Egyptians wanted anything to do with the Jews, so that protected the Jews in Goshen from intermarrying. And as a result, the nation grew in strength and numbers. So God's promise to Abraham was that he would make him a great nation. A nation entails a couple of things. There's a land involved, there's a people, and there's a government that's involved. And all of those things God had to provide. Well, now he's providing the people. He's promised the land, but he's building the people in a place that's safe for them to grow into large numbers. Now, they eventually became slaves, but they still... They still prospered even under those terrible circumstances, and their numbers grew. And this
God
then
does not
was
seem
the
to have a lot of primary concern for physical suffering.
Well,
he let his own son die on the cross. Obviously, he was God, the God man. He suffered. A lot of people here suffer for their faith. Obviously, what you just said about the Israelites having to suffer for the sake of the Canaanites.
God's commitment is not to make our lives comfortable. That is
exactly.
That is not a biblical value.
Absolutely.
It is not to treat everybody exactly the same so everybody gets the same fair treatment. That's not a biblical value. What God cares about is fulfilling a plan to rescue the world. And that's a whole different enterprise than what most people have in mind.
Right, I agree.
And so consequently, like I said, we are expendable for the kingdom's sake, for that purpose that God wants to fulfill. We're expendable for that. And I mean, I don't like that idea. I want all of my interests to be front and center,
Yeah, right.
But God knows best, because it's not just his interests irrespective of us. This is why we've got this great promise in Romans 8, 28 and 29, that we know that God causes all things to work together for good for those who love him, for those who are called according to his purpose, for those whom he foreknew he predestined to become conformed to the image of his son. So he's got these big grand designs that he is working out, but he's got designs for our individual lives that in order to accomplish this great design— There is momentary, as Paul put it, momentary light affliction, which is a way of understating what we feel we're going through. But Paul was comparing that to eternity. Compared to eternity, what we're experiencing is momentary light affliction. Trust me, he says. Trust me on this. And so the hardship we're going through for our discipline is producing for us an eternal weight of glory. Whatever it is that we find ourselves suffering in the midst of, God is redeeming that for something with eternal qualities to it. And that's going to make, the payoff for that is going to make the cost that we pay in this life seem infinitesimally small as time moves forward. So that's God's perspective on it.
One other question real quick to segue in from that one to this one real quick. This will be quicker. Jesus said that seek ye first the kingdom of God and all his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you.
Uh-huh.
He also said that God knows, God feeds the sparrows and makes sure they have food and all this stuff. But yet there are people in third world countries who are starving, and not just third world countries, but in this country as well. Now, how do you apply that and the promise for Paul said, my God, you supply all your needs according to his riches?
Well, Jesus has a way of saying these uncomfortable things, these things that sound good, but then you wonder exactly how they play out.
Exactly.
And I do not know how to answer that in light of the particular way you asked the question. I heard John Piper answer this exact question. I just listened to it about 2 weeks ago. And John Piper, he's a heavyweight. I did not agree with his answer. I did not see how he got the answer he got from the text in question, the one you just cited. There's another one that's similar. No one who has lost husbands and wives and children and houses and estates, et cetera, would not gain that much more in this life and in the life to come. And then he cites all those things again. So it almost sounds like you're going to lose material things, but you're going to get those material things back, kind of like Job did.
Mm-hmm.
And you get it in the life to come, but also in this life. And it doesn't work out that way. So there's a riddle in both of those passages. And, you know, God bless John Piper. He did a yeoman's job trying to put it together. It just didn't resonate with me. He kind of spiritualized it. He said, you will get everything you need for the sake of the kingdom, because they seek ye first the kingdom and all these things will be added, but they'll be added to the degree that they're needed to accomplish the kingdom purposes. Now, he could be right on that, but as I listened to it and as I know the text, I thought, yeah, I'm not entirely persuaded. That's all.
What would you say with something like that where you hear so many preachers and sermons about, you know, God will make sure your needs are met. He'll make sure you have food and shelter. But yet you're thinking in the back of your mind, what about the lady Christian in Ethiopia who can't feed her child? And who prays, you know, she may be a Christian and she's praying for God to give her child food.
Right.
How do you rectify
scripture? That's where I have I'm not going to advance a resolution to that. Look at Pastor Saeed, you know, who is in Iran right now, rotting in an Iranian prison. And, I guess he's got food and a house over his head, but he just certainly isn't arrayed like the lilies of the field. He's arrayed in a swarm of insects. So, so it's just blessed are you when men persecute you, Jesus said. By the way, in the same sermon, for great is your reward in heaven. So, this is part of the balance of how to understand that stuff.
I see.
Okay, I got to run. I got another caller here. Okay, Frank, thank you for your call. Let's talk with Philip here before the hour's done. Philip in Michigan. Phil?
Yes.
Yeah, you're there. Welcome to the show.
Hey, I was going to ask you about Bible difficulty books.
Yeah.
I'm looking to add to my library.
Sure. There's a famous one written by Gleason Archer.
Right.
The Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties or something to that effect. Then there's another. I have two others that are, what is his name? Maybe
John
it's not John. Pardon me?
John Haley?
Say it again.
John Haley?
No. That I think is another book on Bible difficulties. Haley's book of Bible difficulties. But I don't have that. I have another one about difficult. It's called Difficult Passages of the Old Testament. And then there's one called Difficult Passages of the New Testament. I mean, these are books that deal specifically with Bible difficulties. And you can see that in their title. Then there are other books that are meant, and a lot of apologists deal with these. I know William Lane Craig deals with a lot of Bible difficulties in his on his own website at reasonablefaith.org.
Yeah, and his book is actually on my list of books to purchase. But
he doesn't have a book on Bible difficulties. I know he just addresses these challenges. Who's the book that was written by Bill Craig and the fellow that we know from Biola, Asking the Enforcer right now?
A Reasonable Response is one of the
A Reasonable Response,
written.
Yeah, that's right. Joe,
that's
Joe
actually
Gore,
on my
yeah.
list is something I was going to get.
Yeah, and there you've got a lot of stuff there where people offer challenges, but those are philosophic challenges. There are a range of challenges, including Bible difficulties. So he doesn't have a book just of Bible difficulties, but I know he deals with a lot of challenges. And so some of those, there's a particular challenge that has to do with the dating of the Passover, you know.
Right.
And I just read another, I've got another thing I downloaded where he's talking about some difficulties with the Gospels and stuff. So he deals with a lot of stuff like that. But I have some of these books in my library. I just don't use them very much, and this is why I don't know their titles very well, except for the one by Gleason Archer. So he's a solid guy from Trinity. Now I don't think he's alive anymore, but he was a major player over at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. And then there's another John, Old Testament guy. Cannot remember his last name, but I think it's Difficult Passages of the Old Testament and Difficult Passages of the New Testament. And my prior caller raised some difficult passages in the Sermon on the Mount. How are we to understand these promises? And I look at, there are some things, Jesus is always causing trouble as far as I'm concerned. I cannot read the Gospels without coming up with a whole bunch of conundrums. I read a chapter and I say, why did you say this? What did you mean by that? Now what's up with that? You know, he's the hardest guy. He's really hard, I think. And it's just difficult sometimes to figure out what he's about. Fortunately, the main things are the plain things. Trying to figure out all the rest of it is harder, but he's somewhat enigmatic. And you know that passage where it says anybody who gives a cup of water to a prophet will receive the prophet's reward? That's all it takes? Just, I'm going to pass out water, man.
Right.
That's it. It's an easy way to salvation. So now I think that in that case, you're given the water as a sign of fellowship, and you're welcoming them into your home in virtue of the fact that you agree with, you're making common cause with the prophet's message. It's not just an act of giving water that wins you salvation, but the fact that this represents you making common cause with the prophet, and therefore, in virtue of that, signified by the water, you are going to receive the prophet's reward. But yeah, you got to work through those things. Hey, Philip, thanks for the call. And boy, that went fast. What a great hour. But there's more to come. Hour number three, straight ahead. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. The show Stand to Reason, and I'm glad you're on board with us. And Greg Kokel, it's my name, the host. We've got some callers on board. We'll be getting to them shortly. C.S. Lewis in Marriage, Should Christians in Wedding Professions Challenge Other Christians? And Suggestions to Bring One's Wife to Faith. These are all coming up, and maybe more. Hope so. But I have some thoughts here that, again, these were a little bit stray thoughts. Last hour, I talked a bit about some of my reflections about Easter. This is another kind of church service reflection. All kinds of things go through one's mind when you're in a church service, and you know that. And I had mentioned before, I take notes. I always bring my notepad when I go to the service. Sometimes it's because there are things that the pastor says that I want to write down for my own edification, reminder. Sometimes there are clever things that I might work into a talk or pass on to other people like you guys. Sometimes the message stimulates other thoughts, something I want to put into a book or a commentary, and I just don't want to lose it. And so I'm jotting things down. Sometimes there are things that are going on in a service that I have reflections on, and many of you know that I've opined about worship probably more often than you like because of my concern of the trends in worship in churches today. Really troubles me, but I won't get into that right now. Sometimes I see things happening in the audience. Can't miss them, you know, they're close by, whatever, and I have thoughts about that too. And sometimes I'll keep my thoughts to myself. But here's one that I want to mention because I think this happens way more than it ought to. And that has to do with children or young people in church services and then what they do. Now, our young kids, we got a 10 and a 7 now, and I kind of lean towards having our kids in the service, but I know that they like their Sunday school because they're with friends and it's less demanding on their attention spans than being in a service with a bunch of adults. But I think that it's good for them to be in service with adults some of the time. For one, then the family is worshiping together. Somebody said the only time that most families are together on Sunday is when they're driving to the service and when they're driving back from church because they end up going to all different churches, right? The age-appropriate breakdown, youth group, kids groups of various ages, college groups, and then mom and dad are in a service all by themselves. Everybody's going to a different church is what it amounts to. Same location, different church, different pastors, different message, whatever. And that bothers me a little bit. And so I want my girls to be with us. And part of the reason that I want my girls to be with us, even though it's not exactly their cup of tea, is I think it's good for kids to learn to sit and be respectful and pay attention, even though they are under duress a little bit, even though it's not what they want to do. Because I think it's good in itself, to be able to say to a child, I know this isn't what you want to do, but you're still going to do it because it's a good idea for you to get in the habit of doing things that you don't like to do because life is chock full with such things. And the sooner you learn, the better. Now, it doesn't mean we have to, you know, overwhelm them with boring stuff just so they get the discipline of doing what they don't want to do. But it strikes me that having things like that in children's lives is a good thing. And frankly, I have seen families. I know of two families in Wisconsin where I'm very familiar with a lot of people at the EV Free Church, Faith EV Free in Woodruff, Wisconsin, because I've been going there for years. 20 years I've been going there, and 20 years I've been teaching there during the summer. You know, they find a weekend, they plug me in when I'm on holiday there. I like it. And there are two families that have a whole bunch of kids, like eight or nine or ten. I lose count. You know, when there's that many, it's easy to lose count. But there are two families with with two families with that are that size. And you know what? I know they're that size because when I'm teaching on Sunday, there they all are. The younger to the older, now they're kind of split up. Kids are getting married and moving off and stuff like that. But when they're younger, there they all were. They were all sitting there paying attention. They weren't sleeping. They weren't playing video games. They weren't reading comic books. They were sitting politely, respectfully, listening to the sermon and participating. So this is possible. It's doable. I've seen it happen. And so when I see, say, kids, let me back up for a minute. My daughters don't always pay attention to the sermon. They're 10 and 7. What Annabeth, the 10-year-old, does if she doesn't like the sermon is she reads her Bible. So she's finding all kinds of places in the Bible she can read. Well, that's fine with me. That is consistent with the event. Eva, you know, she's just 7 now, 3 months into her 7th year, and I should say this is 3 months into her 8th year because she turned 7 in December. And 4 months, I guess, now, whatever. But see, so she's a little, she got more wiggles. She's a little harder to deal with, okay? And sometimes she nods off and whatever. Okay, I'm sympathetic to that. As kids get older, certainly into their young adult years, which a lot of people call teenage years, but I'm not going to use that word. In the young adult years especially, why is it too much to ask a 12, 13, 14-year-old young person not to play video games on the iPhone while they're in a service? You know, there were kids in those years in the past, boys, young men, 17, 18 years old, who commanded warships. I'm talking tall-masted warships. You know that? That William Wilberforce, when he was a MP, member of Parliament, was like 24 years old. And William Pitt, his close friend, was 26. And he was the prime minister, for goodness sake. So there's no reason that young adults can't be required to demonstrate some kind of adult attentiveness and responsibility just for 45 minutes for a service or maybe an hour. Is that asking too much? I think that kids need to learn to do lots of things at different ages, need to learn to do lots of things they don't want to do. That's life. I don't feel like going to the service today. I heard that, what, a week ago from someone in my family, youngster. My response, so what? What does that have to do with anything? Our attendance at our service is not based on what we feel like at any given moment. How many of you folk have just got up in the morning and said to yourself, I do not feel like going to church today? I'm raising my hand. I feel that almost every single week. It's not any reflection on my church. It's a reflection of being human. Now, sometimes I go for weeks on end not going to my church because I'm in somebody else's church and I'm listening to the same boring speaker every single time. Doesn't matter what church I'm at. All over the country. It's just, they got the same guy, which would be me. That's who I got to listen to. So I'm in somebody else's church. But see, when I've been traveling and finally I got a Sunday off, you think I want to get up and go to church? I don't feel like it. But you know what I do? I rouse my family. We get cleaned up. We go to church. And you know as well as I do, when you do that and you are sitting in church, if you've got a good church, and if you don't, then find one. Aren't you glad you're there? You're together worshiping the Lord, and you have sublimated your own lazy desires at the moment for something better, and when you get into it, you're glad you did it. So, I mean, that's just the way it works. And therefore, if we are parents, don't you think that beginning to teach your children or your young adult to do the same thing is an important thing. Absolutely. Why can't we just say no games? What I want you to do is to sit politely, showing respect for the pastor and the rest of those around you. That itself is a virtue. But I don't want to, and why does that matter? It doesn't. Now, if you want to think about something else, go ahead and think about something else if that's the best you can do, but you don't have to act like you're thinking about something else, especially punching away at a video game on an iPhone. All right? So anyway, that's just my reflection. And I know it's a struggle. I got kids. Try to find a happy medium. But I want my kids to grow into adults. I don't want them to be kids the rest of their lives. And that means you push them in that direction because they do not go that direction on their own. That's why God gave them parents. All right? If it was just a matter of doing what they wanted to do, they can do what they want to do with no parents involved. That's easy. All right. Let's go back to the phones here. I'm just looking at the time. Yeah, we got time. Jump in. And let's talk with Chad here in Santa Fe, California. Hey, Chad.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Glad to.
Hey, I was just on your last thing there. I give my daughter two options. We either go to the 10 o'clock or the 5 o'clock. Your choice.
Oh, see, there you go. You know, my wife taught me that, too, you know, about giving choices to the kids. So you could ask them what they want, and then they're all over the map. You say, okay, it's either this or this. This is a presumptive close.
Yeah.
So you kind of control the options, what's going on, but you also give them a little latitude as well to be a decision maker in the process. That's good.
Absolutely. So I was pondering a little bit what C.S. Lewis wrote about marriage, how, you know, there ought to be two distinct kinds, one governed by the state and one governed by the church, and a distinction that's quite sharp, so you know which couples are married in a Christian sense and which are not. And I think, you know, to me, I think a lot of the problems and the back and forth and arguments going on in the same-sex marriage debate is that we're equivocating the word marriage and legal partnership.
Uh-huh.
So we as Christians are using marriage in the sacred sense, and they're using marriage in a secular legal partnership sense, and it seems to me that I think we're talking past each other because we haven't defined our terms.
Yeah, I think there's something like that going on, but I'm going to say something odd. I know people have argued in light of that distinction that you're making that we should let the religious groups, religious groups should be able to limit their marriage as they wish, but the secular government group should expand it. I think it should be just the opposite. That is, I think that the government should pursue their policy concerns based on the way reality is structured. That is the reason, there is a reason why they have a policy concern. They have a policy that they do, and it has something to do with the nature of community and family and whatever. They have a vested interest in strengthening and building certain types of relationships. Where it comes to religious issues, look, you can follow your own religious sentiments. If in your religion you want to expand on that notion, well, then you can make partnerships that the government has no policy interest in supporting. So I think the religious thing should be the more expansive thing, and the government should be the more restricted thing.
Yeah, I think one of the problems that right now, why I think even your by nature argument is not real persuasive and compelling to me, is that I've adopted children. You have adopted children. You know, the state allows same-sex marriage couples to legally adopt children. You know, I think the argument, you know, if they're allowing same-sex couples to adopt children, then, you know, same-sex marriage or these legal partnerships could possibly stabilize these families by promoting monogamy,
right,
and giving them additional tax and benefits.
Yes, right. Well, certainly the additional tax benefits related to the family make more sense in that case, but I have just a couple of pushbacks. I do not think same-sex couples should be allowed to adopt because that itself is contrary to the established natural order. That is, a child needs a mother and a father, and sometimes they are deprived of a mother and father because of circumstances beyond our control. But to do that by design, I think is a travesty.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out these arguments with my secular friends who, they're just looking at this as a legal partnership.
Yes, I know, right.
If I start talking about nature and
right.
and all this,
okay.
They're like, yeah.
Let me make a distinction here for you, Chad. And this is what I'm going to say strikes me as sad, but good arguments that are sound, appropriate, and consistent with what is true do not persuade people who don't care about any of those things. And so when we offer sound arguments and people aren't persuaded, it doesn't mean that our arguments are bad. It's not a reflection on our argument. It's a reflection on them. The alternative, in my view, is not to give in to them because they're not persuaded by my good argument, so I'm going to go along with their nonsense because they're not persuaded. I'm going to stick by my guns and try to argue for what is good and sound and right and true and vote consistent with that. If they want to drag the train off the rails, well, I can't stop them. But I don't want to be dissuaded from a sound way of thinking of it just because someone can gainsay it. They can just deny it. They can just disregard it. These people you're talking about are not going to be persuaded about what is right. They want what they want, period. So I don't even know. I mean, I want to engage them, but I can't be responsible for the bad decisions they make.
Yeah, and I think it comes again back to the definition of the terms and this equivocation of marriage is I think throwing conversations for a loop every time.
Well, okay, so let's talk about that for a second. My question, I don't think, and maybe you've heard me talk about this before, but I do not think marriage is defined. I think marriage is described. That is, marriage is itself a fixed feature of reality that we use words to point to, but we don't just invent it. And so if we invent it, we can invent it and reinvent it any way we want. Gravity is not defined. It's described. We discover it as a part of reality, and just because we define it away doesn't mean it goes away. I think the same thing is true of marriage. This is why we've seen the institution of marriage across every culture and every religion basically the same way. Some small variations, but the foundation is the same. And cultures have characteristically regulated and privileged and therefore protected this relationship because as a rule, as a group, and by nature, it produces the next generation. Same-sex unions cannot do that. They cannot produce the next generation. No, same-sex couples could
adopt.
Right,
and unfortunately, we let them adopt, so therefore the argument's not as persuasive.
Well, whether the argument, this is back to my earlier comment, whether the argument's persuasive is not the point. There is a reason that the governments, why policy are made regarding certain types of relationship, and I've chosen my words carefully when I say as a rule and as a group. Here's the way policy works. Hard cases make bad policy. What you don't take is extremes and then make policy in virtue of the extreme. And that's what people are doing now when they get confused about these terms marriage. They look at the extreme, the rare cases where same-sex couples do adopt, and so they want to change the nature of marriage or attempt to do that because of these extreme cases. That's bad policy when you do that. There is a benefit for us to continue with the same kind of policy that we've always had, privileging the particular, peculiar relationship that does for the state something valuable. And if the other relationships doesn't do the same for the state, then there's no reason for us to step in. But see, even talking about this, Chad, even with people who don't find this persuasive, it's because they are thinking about marriage in an entirely different way. They aren't thinking about the reasons that conjugal marriages are supported by the government. They are thinking about how they can reorganize culture to a different understanding of what is good. So this is cultural engineering that's going on by attempting to redefine marriage to make homosexual unions appear to be the exact same kind of unions that heterosexual unions are. But they're not the same. They're not, I mean, forget about religion for the moment. With regards to the policy issue, they're not the same.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean the travesty part, which I agree with you, is that you're denying them a mother or a father.
In the case of the children, that's right.
Yeah, it's not that they would be bad parents. It's just you're denying them that part of their lives, essentially.
A child doesn't need two really, really, really good dads or two really, really good moms. They need a mother and they need a father. My wife and I provide entirely different things for our daughters. And both are, when I say necessary, I don't mean absolutely necessary. I mean they're appropriate for the relationship. That is, some people can get by without one or the other. But all single parents know that they're operating at a disadvantage because something's missing. And single moms are not looking for other women to hang out with them to provide for their children what their children don't have with a single mom. They're looking for other dads or other men to be in relationship with their children in some way to provide what she is not able to provide as a mother. This is as obvious as the day is long. And for somebody who says, well, what studies have shown that? The person who asked that question is missing what ought to be prima facie obvious to everybody. But now the studies are coming out, and more of them making it abundantly clear that that same-sex unions provide a substandard a parenting experience for the child.
Yeah, well, I think you can ask anyone who came from a divorced parent that they wished they'd had both parents there.
Right, absolutely, no doubt.
But I really appreciate you taking the time and helping to clarify some of my thinking around.
And thanks for being generous to me as I'm pushing back on some of your thoughts. I don't want to give in to the other side because they're not persuaded, you know, and I don't want to just, okay, we'll adopt two versions of marriage because that's like saying, well, okay, two versions of gravity.
Yeah, well, and that brings other issues anyways. You know, if Muslims don't allow divorce without husband approval or if Catholics don't recognize certain divorces, you know, there's other issues going on with that, too. So.
The government policy ought to be established government power should be used to accomplish a legitimate end. That from a policy perspective, and marriage licenses for heterosexuals does accomplish that end. It accomplishes no legitimate end for same-sex couples. What it does is just it's a strong-arm attempt at social engineering, trying to get the law to reflect, which is obviously false, that same-sex unions and heterosexual unions are exactly the same. They're not. But this is about social engineering. It's not even about rights, frankly. All right, Chad, thank you for the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Let's go to break and then back with more of your calls on Stand to Reason.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to Timothy, his disciple, and encouraging Timothy to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure in 2 Timothy 1:14. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman who has the job of protecting those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that's been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. It reflects the heartbeat of Stand to Reason, too. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we're training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful resources to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's str.org.
Stand to Reason's new Quick Reference app is now available for free on Apple, Android, and Windows mobile devices. the STR Quick Reference app summarizes the information you need to know about tactics, abortion, and other relevant topics through text and video, equipping you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the most important issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Download the STR Quick Reference app today and be prepared to respond with knowledge, wisdom, and character everywhere you go.
Just talking with Amy Hall here during break. She, of course, sitting listening to the show, quantifying it, putting it in her blog the next day. But we were just reflecting on broadly this question. Why is it that those on the left, in particular homosexuals, why is their skin so thin? Apparently, the New York Times just ran an article, this is what Amy said, that we ought to be obliged to take homosexuality off our sin list. Excuse me? Do you see the radical totalitarian impulse that's reflected in that? You can't even be allowed to declare your moral point of view on this issue. Aren't racists still allowed to be racist in this country? I'm not making a parallel. I'm just using an extreme example. Aren't they still allowed to have their own point of view, as disgusting and despicable as that happens to be? Aren't they still allowed to have it? I mean, practicing it is a different matter. We have to take it off of our sin list? Says who? The New York Times? Oh, my goodness. So what this reflects is how thin their skin is. They cannot even countenance an alternate opinion. Basically, they're saying we ought to be forced not to ever express such an opinion. We can't even have it in print. This is why the guy who is the chief of the fire department there in Atlanta lost his job, because he had it in print, his own view in print, that homosexuality was a sin in a Christian book that he wrote. One page he mentions that. He's out of a job. You're fired because you have the wrong ideas. Do you see what's happening here? You have the wrong ideas. You're fired. Oh, that's on your sin list? You're fired. Because we're the tolerant ones. Oh, how about this? We mean that in the most tolerant way possible. You're fired. All right. Why is it that their skin is so thin? Why is it that they cannot countenance any pushback, any alternate opinion, any hint that there's something amiss in homosexual behavior? It strikes me as extremely obvious. And Shakespeare had it right. I mean, that is, he expressed it so well. Methinks thou dost protest too much. I don't even know what play that's from, but boy, is it true. Sometimes people protest so vigorously that it shows there's something else going on, because their protestation is far and beyond the normal bounds or limits. Well, that's the definition of an inordinate. It's an inordinate reaction. You know, like when you come home from work and there's a little thing out of place and you blow your stack, a wise spouse is going to think something else is going on here, because that circumstance didn't justify that response. So what else is going on here? I'll tell you what I think is going on here. I think the people involved here understand deeply that there's something wrong with homosexuality. And they are so in touch with that thing that they don't want to be true, they are not going to allow anyone to remind them of it. I remember years ago there was a commentary that somebody wrote who is a homosexual. And he said, why can't we homosexuals have the courage of our own convictions, the confidence of our own convictions? Why do we have to silence everybody who disagrees? That shows weakness, not strength. That was his point. I think it was a good one. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, the enforcer just said that they think it's exactly the same as racism, and that's the outrage. I think that their temptation to think of it the same as racism is part of the problem. It's a way of rationalizing and justifying their own thing. It clearly is not the same. There's not any similarity whatsoever between the two. For skin color is morally benign. Who thinks otherwise, for goodness sake? Secondly, skin color is something you're born with and that is unchangeable, immutable. That is not the case with sexual identity and sexual preferences. We know it's not the case. Every researcher says the same thing. It doesn't matter what their convictions are about homosexuality. They still say the same thing. There's no gay gene. It's not innate. It's not constitutional. It's developmental. Nobody is born this way. Anyway, okay, enough of that. Let's go to Eddie in San Diego. Hey, Eddie.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
Okay, sir.
Good. The commentary you just made is right on. I was just nodding my head along with what you're saying. And I'm sorry to say, I know you're kind of sick of having to address this topic, and I am too, but I'm kind of calling about the same thing, which is a little embarrassing.
Well, that's all right. It's your call.
Yeah, so you actually called me here a couple weeks ago in San Diego. And you may remember I'm the photographer.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, well,
nice.
So knowing that
you,
I'm a wedding photographer, you probably know.
Yes, right.
Yeah, so I'll give you just a tiny background. I've been shooting weddings since the mid-90s. It's a very much a huge part of who I am and who, you know, what our business is. And we kind of decided long ago to, you know, to stand our ground in regards to same-sex wedding photography. So we don't shoot them, but people who we genuinely know and love in our industry are becoming more and more hostile towards our beliefs.
Mm-hmm. By the way, let me ask you, have you, if you don't mind me asking, you can beg off on this if you want to, but have you actually been confronted with people who asked about it and you said no?
You know,
or you haven't crossed that bridge yet?
Haven't crossed it in a big way. We did a post about it a few years ago and we were confronted a couple times just in private. We've had a couple people ask us, but we've bowed out or just happened to not be available, so it worked out kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Truthfully, it's tricky in our industry because we shoot for other photographers regularly. It's part of how we survive and how we help each other.
Right.
Yeah, so we're independent contractors, and sometimes I'll show up at a wedding and not even know if it's going to be a same-sex wedding or not.
Well, if that strikes me as giving you a little bit more protection because you can privately have a conversation with the whoever's been contracted for the work. So the work is already contracted. It's going to get shot. And you could tell them, you know, for myself, I don't want to participate in that. Person is unlikely to go after you because you've turned down a contract opportunity for them. Oh.
Right.
Or a subcontracting opportunity, right?
You're absolutely right about that. And I think the legal issue with the Indiana thing and everything, I think that's less of a concern for me just in regards to kind of what you've been talking about. It's very obvious, you know, that we're dealing with something different here in legal terms. But when it comes to our identity in the industry, that's a bigger challenge because, like I said, I mean, we rely on referrals from other professionals and other people. It's basically, I feel like we're in the closet almost. And, you know, there are people in our industry who know that, you know, who know where we stand. But even believers are becoming, I mean, we almost don't know any believers who are photographers who are unwilling to shoot same-sex weddings.
Is that because of their conscience or because of their fear of the law?
You know, I don't know.
Or fear of consequences.
I don't think it's a fear of the law, to be honest. I think it's kind of sad that people are, that believers are kind of just starting to, you know, let the pushback take over.
Yeah. Well, it might be that, look, I can see how there are Christians who have no conscience problems with it. They may think that same-sex marriage is wrong, but they don't think they are wrong in participating in it.
Yeah.
So that might I can see that. It's a
and,
hybrid,
you know,
kind of view, but
I'm sorry.
No.
Well, I think that's kind of where my question is going, I guess. I'm just wondering if this is you know, the hill we want to die on, because if we kind of come out strongly against it, it could literally end the biggest part of our business.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I guess I'm just trying to figure out what the best way to go about handling it. Should we just straight up tell everybody that, you know, it's against a religion, or do we just wait for inquiries to come and say, hey, we're not available or we're not a good fit?
Yeah, well, you keep in mind when Jesus gave instructions to the apostles in Matthew 10 about preaching city to city and that they were going to encounter pushback and persecution, I think that's the passage where he says, if they persecute you in one city, flee to the next.
Right.
And we see Paul being lured over the wall in a basket, you know, to escape. And we see also in Philippi and other places, Ephesus maybe. But when you read through Acts, you see that there is a wise tendency towards flight. That is, you avoid persecution if you can. So I don't think that it's wise to wave your flag and draw attention to yourself. I think flying under the radar as long as you can is a good idea. And I have also put together a recommendation regarding those who are involved in weddings about how they might maneuver a little bit to protect themselves. Have you ever heard me talk about that?
You know what? That particular topic is new to me, actually. That's interesting.
Okay. What I'm going to try to do, if the enforcer or somebody can remind me, I'll forward the detail to them, and maybe we can post this. But the upshot is the first request that you get with regards to a same-sex union is you don't throw your hand at all. You just said, before I can answer that, I need to have some particulars about the people in the wedding. And so give me your names, both parties that are involved, and the church and the pastor, et cetera, and I need to check this out. Okay, so it's a stalling tactic. The overall approach here is what you want the prospective client to do is to disqualify you, not the other way around.
Right, right, right.
Okay, so you don't commit yourself at all regarding these things. You just say, I need to check out the details. Thank you so much for the call, and then you say goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
You don't say, I'll call back.
Right.
You say, I want to check out the details. Now, it might be that this is a phony call. They're just trying to snag you and give you a lawsuit, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that happens. And so you might check out the details and find out there is no such party. There is no such thing happening at a church. And then you are free from even considering the request if you find it to be bogus, all right?
Right.
Now, it may turn out to not be bogus, but think of it from the perspective of the person who's looking for a service provider, right? Like a photographer for a wedding. They're calling around, finding people. They're comparing prices, comparing personalities, trying to find a person that, you know, they feel good with working with, right? And so they call you, and you don't call them back.
Right.
You know, and so, gee, you know, well, I'm not going with that guy. I'm going with somebody else. All right. So so maybe they're not going to call you back and it's over with because you're a little too hard for them to work with. Now, what if they do call you back? Well, then I think you could say, what are you looking for in a photographer? Are you looking for somebody that can celebrate with you in this important event in your life? Blah, 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 blah. Oh, yeah, that's what we're looking for. Well, I don't think I'm the right person for you. Because I do not feel like I can celebrate with you, given my own convictions about this, and therefore it's probably going to have an impact in the quality of the work. Not that I'll try to give you the short shrift, but you see what I'm talking about. So maybe they're going to say, yeah, you're not the best person for us. So then they disqualify you at that point. And I think the third step is if they still want you, even though you're not the right person, then you can say, well, I for the reasons I stated, I cannot participate in this. Now that's the first time you've said no. And so it's the first time that you're vulnerable to some kind of legal action. But at least you put it off a couple of stages.
Yeah.
That's the idea. If there's some way you can get them to disqualify you rather than you disqualify them, then you're off the hook, it seems to me.
Yeah, and you know that it's kind of a rabbit hole of an issue, I guess you could say, because, like I said, for second shooters, you know, we'll often show up and not know anything about the wedding until we get there because it's not our contract.
Yeah, but you could ask about it, though, with your friend or as a subcontractor, you can ask about that, right?
Yes, it's not normal practice. I mean, people ask, where is it, what time, and the date, and that's kind of
right. But now, of course, times have changed, and so now it becomes a different matter.
Right.
You know.
So, I mean, are you comfortable with believers saying, you know, I don't have a major moral issue because I'm not necessarily celebrating, I'm just doing a job?
Well, that would be their conviction about that. So the question isn't whether I'm comfortable with it. The question is whether they're comfortable with it.
Yeah.
I think it is a matter of conscience one's conscience informs them whether their participation is going to be an immoral participation. I think there are right answers and wrong answers to moral questions, but I do think sometimes the line is ambiguous. And when the line is ambiguous, this is where we have to allow for Christian charity and differences of opinion.
Sure.
So,
yeah, and you know, we are sometimes asked to photograph newborns, and they happen to have parents who aren't wed, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that where we're kind of finding ourselves in a similar situation.
Yeah, it strikes me that even though the fact that the parents aren't wed, the taking of the picture of the newborn does not somehow cause you to participate in that.
Right.
It strikes me is a different thing.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, my wife just read a blog post from somebody in the industry who was writing about Matthew 5:40. About, you know, if Roman oppressors ask you to carry their gear, she was basically saying, you know, we should be the first ones there, and we should be carrying,
bake them too.
Going the extra mile. Do you think that applies to our situation?
No, I think that's a radical distortion of Jesus' teaching, and actually our number one of our broadcast, we went in quite a bit of detail regarding that.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Here the counterexamples, okay? If somebody asked you to film a pornographic film, film two. Okay?
Right.
If somebody asked you to steal a coat for them, steal them two coats.
Right.
What Jesus is referring to is an action that's morally benign. But the particular objection that Christians have is that participating in these services, ceremonies, makes them complicit in something that's immoral. Mm-hmm. Jesus would never tell you to double your efforts in something that you think was immoral. Mm-hmm. Now, the person who wrote that said herself, though she identified herself as a Christian, she does not think same-sex unions are immoral. Here she is quoting out of Matthew 5 or 6 or 7, whatever, in the Sermon on the Mount. Later on in Matthew, Jesus says, from the beginning, it's been this way, it has not been this way, divorce, but God made them male and female, and the two that come together, let no man put aside, one flesh. It's really clear what Jesus' point of view is on this one. So would we say, yeah, well, if somebody wants a divorce, give them two divorces?
Right.
You know, this is such a shallow response. Because it mischaracterizes the opinion of the person who's objecting to participate. The opinion that they have is that participating is an act, is participating in something that's against God's purposes, and if it's against God's purposes, it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What would Jesus say? Yes, if it's against God's purposes, do it twice. Is that what she understands? She disagrees that it's against God's purposes. Fine. Then she should follow her conviction, and then she should let those who have a different conviction follow theirs. But she never engages the question whatsoever. She just piously parades this verse out before them. And you know how many? She usually has 100 people that read her blog. You know how many hits this got? How many readings this one got? 300,000.
So you know about this?
Oh yeah,
blog.
We dealt with it specifically in the first hour.
How I didn't realize it was about that actual entry. I'm definitely going to have to listen to that.
Yeah, yeah. First hour of the show. You can check that out.
I definitely will.
Yeah, and we read from it, and so we got the whole thing down. It's been an object of conversation because we know a lot of Christians are influenced by this foolish challenge.
Right.
And I say it's a fool. I don't want to be abusive at all to the young lady who wrote this. I don't want to be like intellectually abusive, but I just think, goodness gracious me, it is such sloppy thinking to make the application she did to the thing that we're talking about. Because who would take exception with carrying a coat or taking a, I mean, there's no parallel there at all. There's none. And it turns out there are other things that Jesus said that make that dictate something entirely different. And she ought to believe Jesus' view about marriage is what she ought to believe if she's so concerned about what Jesus had to say about things.
Exactly.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. Well, you know, I
in a minute I'll tell you how I really feel.
Well, being in the industry, I'm regularly confronted with this, and I'm just kind of exhausted from it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know that you confront it pretty regularly on the show, and I appreciate you being patient, especially today. It seems like a very redundant question, but
that's all right.
Thank you for.
Yeah,
for
glad to do so, Eddie, and I appreciate your conscience about this and your concern about being a faithful Christian.
Yeah, and thank you so much for your ministry. I tell you every time I see you, but I've heard you since high school, and I'm 38. So thank you so much for all you do.
You're welcome, Eddie. Thank you so much for the call.
Take care.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye. What matters here to me is fidelity to Christ. This is what matters. Faithfulness to Christ. Friendship with the world is hostility towards God. That's James. Fear of man brings a snare. That's Proverbs. There's two verses that you can use. All right. As to the propriety of same-sex marriage, there ought to be no question in any biblical Christian's mind about this because Jesus weighed in such a fashion that his view could not be in question. And for somebody to flippantly quote something else Jesus said, to support a case in favor of same-sex marriage or participating, and it's just, to me, ludicrous. It's just ludicrous. So, anyway, we have a break. Do we have a break? Yeah, we got another caller coming up. Let's go to break, and we'll come back to our final caller, Jason in Cypress, California, about witnessing to his wife. Coming up on Stand to Reason.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to idonate.com. and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Final segment here on Stand to Reason. And we have Jason been holding on for quite a while in Cypress, California. Hi, Jason. Thank you for your patience.
Oh, no problem, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. So what's on your mind?
Well, first, I just want to thank you for everything you do. My dad actually turned me on to all your material. Gosh, I'm going to say probably within the last year to 18 months, and a lot of other people, like Lee Strobel, William Lane Craig, and many others. So
has greatly influenced my wife.
Oh, that's great. Those two are good men that you mentioned. There's a whole bunch more too.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm getting as much material as I can. Actually, I have a majority of your CDs, and I was able to listen to them in one day's commute here in Southern California.
So.
Reason for my call, though, let me kind of give you the background. I've been married now for going on almost 2 years. Me and my wife dated for 5 years before we got married. She was raised Catholic. Wasn't at the time when I met her a practicing Catholic. Mm-hmm. Pretty much was the Christmas and Easter Catholic.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Going with her mom to those services. But that was pretty much it. When through the dating process, we talked about our future and kind of what the expectations were. It's why I asked her what her expectations were, and she didn't really have any. I kind of explained mine to her. Well,
spiritually, you're talking about spiritually speaking, right?
Sure, sure, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, as far as having kids in the future, how they would be raised.
Oh, yeah, I got you. Okay. By the way, would you have considered yourself at this time a Christian?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Well, that's a whole other story. I was raised Christian and had a falling out with the church in my teen years, as most rebellious kids do.
Yeah.
And came back to Christ in my early 20s.
But you had come back when you were dating, by the time you were dating your wife, is that correct?
Before I met her.
Before he, okay, good. That helps out. So,
yeah, before I met her.
Okay.
So, right now, she is, so that, we kind of laid out all the, you know, the ground rules beginning. So, she would come to church with me before we got married. She still does to this very day. She would come to church with me every Sunday, but still hold on to a little bit of the old, I guess, or just kind of what she grew up with and
right.
what she knows.
Right.
And, hasn't, been baptized yet, and I kind of think that's something important. Now, obviously, I know this isn't a choice that I can make for her. There's nothing I can really do to push her in that direction, and that's something that she's going to have to decide for herself. I was just wanting to get your input and any advice. Maybe if there's any books out there that would kind of help her or any type of advice you could give.
Well, yeah, I have some thoughts. I was raised Catholic myself, and so one of the things that stood out for me as a Catholic was that I knew that I was a sinner. You know, I had a clear picture from my upbringing of the justice of God, but I did not have a clear picture of the grace of God. And so when I left the Catholic Church, then some 4 or 5 years later, my younger brother Mark began to share the gospel with me. I heard from him something I had never really heard before, and that is that I could know that I was going to heaven. And this was not something that Roman Catholics focused in on. In fact, you couldn't know. You hoped you would go to heaven. I look back now, knowing what I know about hell, I don't know how the gospel could be considered good news if it was an iffy proposition. You know, well, maybe you make it, maybe you don't. You know, so it's good news, but we're not sure how good. Maybe it's not good news if maybe I don't make it following this gospel. There couldn't possibly be good news. So what impressed me at the time was the idea that, as Mark shared with me, I could know I have eternal life. That eternal life didn't start when I died and then found out whether I went to heaven or not, but it could start now. This is eternal life that you know the Lord, nor the Father, and this is in John 17. So what I did is I put together, and I have to go quickly here because we're almost out of time, I put together a series of verses that I thought would really be helpful for a Roman Catholic who had the background that I did, that yes, there was God and whatever, but you didn't really understand grace. And the first one was Ephesians 2:8-9. By grace you are saved through faith, that not of yourselves, it's a gift of God, not of works, lest any man boast. Okay, so I wanted them to understand that my salvation was a gift and it wasn't something I earned. This is very different from what I learned in Catholicism, but there it was in the scripture. Then I wanted to focus on, in virtue of the fact that salvation is a gift, if I received Christ, this is John 1:12 or so, as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believed in his name. So if I received Jesus, then I have Jesus. Okay. If I receive him, then I have him. Okay. Then I flip to 1 John chapter 5. And this is the key verse to kind of wrap it all together. I'm going to try to find it here, but I think I know it mostly by memory. And 1 John chapter 5 says, "The witness is this, that God has given us eternal life, and this life is in his Son." This is 5:11 through 13. "The witness that God has given us eternal life." Well, that's consistent with having received Christ and the gift of salvation, the other two verses, right? Okay, "He who has the Son has the life. He who does not have the Son does not have the life." Okay, that's pretty straightforward. I receive him, I have him, I got the life. Then he says this, "These things I have written to you who believe in the name of the Son of God, in order that you may know that you have eternal life." So now John is saying that having eternal life is a function of knowledge. It isn't just a hope in the future. You can know it. How can you know it if you have Jesus? Well, how would you have Jesus if you received him? And you receive him by faith. And it's a gift. It's not of works, lest any man boast. So you see how those verses work together.
Yeah,
Ephesians 2, 8, 9, the John 1, 12 or 13, 14, somewhere in there. And then this, 1 John 5, 11 through 13. So instead of, in a sense, taking exception with Catholicism, if instead you say, well, look, it, let's just look at these passages and help her to see faith is a gift, or rather salvation is a gift. If you receive Christ, you have Jesus. And if you have Jesus, you know you have eternal life. So there's a little string of verses that might help, maybe in conversation with your wife. Let the Word of God do the work.
Absolutely. Well, I really appreciate it. I'll go over these with her tonight. And we've had the conversation even about baptism, and she's just, well, kind of when I'm ready, you know. So
I'd say let that one go for now. You want to get her conviction.
Sure.
That she, you know, understanding these verses, these elements, once you get these elements in place, then I think the baptism thing will take care of itself, because the baptism of the Spirit comes before baptism. I mean, regeneration comes before the baptism by water. And I think that will be a lot easier once she's spiritually regenerated. Jason, thank you so much for the question. I hope that was helpful. And that's it for us today. This evening, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, thank you so much for spending your time with me here. And give them heaven this week, okay? That would be a good idea. What do you think? I'm Greg Kolkel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.